Welcome to Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. I am your host, Michael TYP Cole. This is episode 50, and with us tonight we have Johnny Metz.
Oh, hi.
Greg.
Hello there.
And our fearless leader, John Lindemann.
Hiya.
And let's see here. I've got a good...
This can't be happening! No, this is not Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which is a very fine show, by the way. I hope you all listen to it. This is actually Radio Free Nintendo. It's episode 138, and as you heard, TYP is joining us this week as a special guest, all the way from Japan land.
Konnichiwa, brothers.
Yeah, bitches. Konnichiwa, bitches.
See, now you know he's there.
Yep.
That's true, yes.
But anyway, yeah, he's here. James could not be with us tonight. Something about basketball. I don't know. Any old excuse to get out of the show.
Yep.
But we're happy to have Mr. Lindemann back.
Hey,
how are you, sir?
I'm doing all right, you know, all things considered.
Yeah, all things considered. We'll get to that later. Yeah, so we got a big show, and we're going to jump into new business. And as usual, our special guest is going first. And John doesn't quite count as a special guest, so 2IP, please go.
Aw, okay. Let's see. So first off, as I wrote, I guess about a month ago, in the impressions, I've been playing Metroid Prime on Wii, on my Japanese Wii. Mm-hmm. I've been kind of nibbling at it here and there. I haven't really been playing it hardcore. So last night I got, the infrared visor. So I'm not like all that far into it, I guess. It's a lot of fun to revisit. I mean, the new controls really work well. It feels like you're playing essentially Metroid Prime 3. It doesn't feel tacked on at all. Really isn't much added to it as far as I can tell, though. They have the awards where you get...
Yeah, the tokens.
Whatever. I mean, I guess it's nice to throw it in there, but it's not a big deal.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you have any indication that Retro Studios did the port to Wii, or...
Absolutely. In fact, in the Japanese version, they have in the back of the manual, they have the credits in English, and there is like a Metroid Prime Wii version credits, and then original Metroid Prime credits,
right,
and like Retro Studios is listed in both, and people from Retro Studios are listed in both.
Nice.
So it's pretty explicit that I'd say maybe a third of the size of, like, in terms of number of people, about a third of the people that worked on the original just eyeballing it.
Those are the only ones who are still left at the company.
Well, it is their motion control. It is their Wii controls in this case, isn't it? Say for instance, like Mario Power Tennis. Obviously, those controls are entirely sort of new. They haven't been done before. Whereas with the unique situation of having already done Metroid Prime 3, the controls have kind of already been made by Retro, so it would make sense for them to then implement them in another game.
Yeah, and I get the sense that Camelot was not really involved.
Yeah, I would guess they
Mario
were.
Mario Power Tennis.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
On the Camelot website, they actually show it on their page. So,
well,
maybe it's... They get some kickback from it.
I've heard some pretty bad things about it. I guess the reviewer at our site liked it, but...
Dude, you don't original Mario Power Tennis. You can't.
No, I don't. I really don't. I think it's kind of a bloated mess. I really like the N64 version, and I always thought, wow, what could you really add to make this better? And Mario Power Tennis shows that, well, you can add a lot of things, but they're not really going to make it better.
I'll tell you what was better about it. There's the fact that you didn't have the N64 analog stick. If you was playing some sort of five-set thriller in the N64 version, it killed your thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely killed it, whereas the GameCube is much more forgiving, so turn off all the power shots and pretend you play the N64 version with a good stick.
I have to say, I never owned Power Tennis. I played it at press events and just could not get into it, didn't care for it. And I don't know, the Wii controls do not sound very attractive to me at all.
Yeah, well, the biggest concern that I would have had with that from a conceptual level is in the N64 version and in the GameCube game, obviously, it's fundamentally about powering up your shot, and when you power up your shot, you're almost fixed to the ground, but not quite. But obviously, that's dependent on you holding a button press. Now, of course, one can't hold a motion. You can't sort of.
It just
doesn't make much sense to me. It's a purely timing-based game.
Yeah, so they've had to work around it in a number of ways. Like, I think what happens is that basically if you stop moving, you automatically start charging. And the motion will activate stuff. So it sounds a bit awkward. People say, oh, Mario Party, oh, it's such an obvious choice. And in some ways it is, but in many ways it really isn't. Certainly not as much as Metroid Prime.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about the charging aspect. That definitely does. When I wrote my review for the GameCube version, who reviewed it? I'm blanking out here. Was it?
Mike Gammon, wasn't it?
I mean, Mike Gammon, Pale. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it Pale? Okay. He pointed out in my review that I call it like a fighting game on the GameCube version, because it is a lot like a fighting game. It's quick back and forth, timing based. You have to focus hard, and if you're mismatched, it's not fun. Just like with a traditional fighting game.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like they really have turned it into a different game, for better or worse. I haven't played it. I really can't say whether I like it. I like the idea of Nintendo making another tennis game that allows you to move yourself around the court. So I like that. Whether or not this iteration of a tennis game makes sense, I don't know.
I'm a lot more interested in EA's attempt at it with Grand Slam Tennis. That has Motion Plus also, but I'm also just kind of looking forward to their fresh take on it, because the Mario Tennis thing and Mario Golf, to me, have both been played out pretty much. And what about this Pulse Man?
Ah, yes, Pulse Man. I figured I should buy something on Virtual Console because I have a Japanese Wii. And what's the point of buying one if I don't do that? So I went to the store and I bought a Wii Point card from the store, and I bought it in yen. Okay, all right. I bought Pulse Man and it's actually a lot of fun. I think it's actually a really good candidate for one of these import festival type things.
I think I saw something. It's definitely been rated by one of the Western ratings boards. It could be like the Australian, it could be European, or it could be American. I can't remember, but it was rated by one of them. And I would assume if it's going to come to one Western territory, it'll probably come to both eventually. Mm. So yeah. I would think it probably is going to be in, which is good, because I agree. Yeah. I like this.
I mean, it's
a
great can. I mean, Game Freaks obviously has close relationship with Nintendo, and Sega is all about the Virtual Console too. So Game Freak developed it, Sega published it. I'm sure that everyone can be happy and work together on Virtual Console and get money.
It's been a while since we really had many import games on Virtual Console. So maybe whenever they finally get back around to doing it.
I think supposedly there's going to be a couple finally from Hudson at some point this month, like Twinbee and something else.
There's
supposed to be like a couple of import games from Hudson, which would be their first Virtual Console game since October, but other than that, I haven't heard much.
Mm. Right, well, Pulse Man is actually a lot of fun. It feels kind of like a weird mishmash of a bunch of different action platformers, but in a good way. The basic concept is you're this... Actually, let me tell you the story, the supposed plot that, as I understand it, the professor has developed this new form of life that lives in a computer called Sea Life, and he falls in love with one of these creations, so he enters the computer, and they somehow combine, and a kid is created, and he's able to like go between the land of computers, inside computers, and the real world.
Is this like Lawnmower Man or something like that?
Or Auto Man?
No.
Look that up on YouTube.
The weirdest, the bizarrest part of it is that apparently your father has gone insane because he's lived in the computer world for so long, and he's now the villain, and he's like a terrorist or something, wreaking havoc on the city. So this bastard child mixture of computer man somehow has to fight his father. That's some crazy shit. So if I may actually talk about the Pulse Man game, it feels a bit like... somewhere between Mario and Mega Man in terms of like platforming, and the combat kind of reminds me of Drill Dozer in that you're kind of limited in your moveset, but it kind of tries to exploit the moveset for all it's worth.
Oh, that's what Klonoa's like too. Of course, that's a different developer, but
You have like you have a beam sword you can swipe, but it's kind of rigid. But if you move around, you kind of store electrical charge, and you can use that to either shoot like a beam that goes for a distance. Or you can use it to... It's kind of like, I guess, Pikachu's Thundershock or something. Not Thundershock. What's the one where he can melee, where he can like teleport.
Oh, is it? Oh, I don't know. It's agility.
The
upbeat
one. Anyway, it's kind attack. Of it's kind of like that, except he attacks, and the more electrical charge you've built up, the further you attack, and eventually, if you have like enough charge or you've collected enough stuff, it's kind of like the final smash attack for Pikachu in Brawl, where he's just sort of bouncing.
He just
around
kind of bounces
room.
Around so constantly.
It sounds like Nightcrawler. Yeah. Sounds like a mixture of the Nightcrawler teleportation attacks between the first X-Men game on Genesis. And for the final move, it would be more like the one he has in the X-Men arcade game.
I'm not familiar with that game, so I can't. It's too bad. I don't know, but it works pretty well. And the levels are actually really different. Each level really feels different. It really looks different. And there's an interesting contrast between like the real world and when you go inside a computer, kind of the backgrounds.
Yeah, it's very very psychedelic.
Yeah. Okay. So you've played this too, Jim. Great.
Yeah, that's right. It's very psychedelic when you're in the computer things, but even when you're outside, like, it's pretty wacky.
Yeah.
It was like, there's an Indian swamp level, but it's like, there's all electronics in the swamp as well. Like, it's quite, you know, it's quite fantastical, even in the outside world.
Right, and one of the levels is shows the pedigree of Pokemon in it, because it will induce seizures. I guarantee you. If there's one reason they don't bring it over, it's because...
It's right there in the title, isn't it?
I guess so.
See, but that's totally cool now, because Nintendo warns you when you turn on your Wii, so...
Oh, yeah.
Their ass is covered.
It is.
You know, I wonder if maybe that's part of the reason it hasn't been brought to America yet.
Maybe. I don't know, but my pseudo-thesis in college was about this warning label Nintendo gives and how that's as good as they need to do. I agree with that, actually. It's not even a joke. Nintendo can't be bending over backwards to avoid any possibility of a seizure, because there's no way to 100% avoid that possibility.
Absolutely. That's why they did it.
Anyway, we're getting off topic again. So I think it's a really good game. The boss battles are pretty interesting. Some of them kind of force you to use your short-range attacks versus your long-range attacks. And like one of them requires you to run while you're doing it. So there's a lot of variety. I will say I don't like the three-hit kill system. It seems kind of shoddy. They do have, you know, health
pickups.
There's
a few occasions where it feels a bit much, you know, like, because if you get into being able to be repeatedly hit within a fairly brief period. Sometimes it seems fine, and then other times it just,
like with some of the boss battles, when you don't know what to do, it's like, you know? It's not like Sonic game where you could just collect that one ring back over and over again until you figure out what you're supposed to do.
It's quite different.
But it is a good game. I really think it's solid, if a little weird and quirky. But it's,
I'd
you know,
like
most of the important stuff isn't already in English. Like, some of the text is already in English. The voices are in English.
And it's totally playable for someone
voices,
like
me. I should say the voice is in English, because it sounds like every character has the exact same voice.
Well, it's Genesis, so...
Yeah, at least it's not the Altered Beast voice, come on.
Power up.
Yeah, this is a little better than
that. I do that anytime.
Mr. Lindemann.
Yes, sir.
All right, man, you've had a couple weeks off here, so... I hear you got a lot of free time on your hands.
I do actually have a lot of free time on my hands. I got laid off this week, so that's kind of been, it's a burn, let me tell you. The stuff I've been playing, actually, I've been really busy. It's kind of ironic, because last week I couldn't make the podcast because I was working my ass off, and this week, the same place that I was working my ass off for laid me off, so I got it coming and going. But yeah, so this week I've been playing Trackmania DS. I got a review copy of that in, and it's funny. If anybody's played Trackmania on the PC, the whole idea of the game is it's almost like a slot car racing game where you have to get through a course in a set amount of time, or you basically have to get a gold medal, you have a certain time to beat, and they're all very simple courses. And it's very good for the DS, because it's completely pick up and play, because you just you go through one course, you know, it's just you, just your car, you're not racing anyone, even though you can do that on the PC. I haven't really gotten far enough in there. It doesn't look like there's anything like that in the DS. It looks like it's just a straight kind of one player sort of thing on the DS so far, but...
There aren't any online modes in the DS game, because there was a hubbub over that.
Yeah,
it's a very online centric PC title.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
a
pretty radical difference.
They have, the only thing that's in there is you can race other people over the wireless play. Yeah, you know, the yeah.
And, which do they have any sort of infrastructure for trading like custom levels?
I believe they do. I believe you can trade custom because you can open up new stuff and create your own custom levels. So, and I believe that you can trade them to your friends.
Online?
I'll confirm that. Not online though. There's no online. From what I can tell, there's no online in it whatsoever. Which is I mean Johnny's absolutely right. It doesn't make much sense because
it's kind of like putting World of Warcraft on. I mean, it's not the same, but it's a bit like making an offline World of Warcraft for DS.
Like, yeah. And like furthermore, what puzzles me is that it's made by I was playing the game and I'm like, wow, this feels like something I've played before. And it does. It feels exactly like Race Driver, Create and Race.
Yeah.
And that's because it's done by Firebrand Games, which is made by which is the same company. And that game has online play. Yet this game doesn't.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like it's not bad. I mean, it's running the same engine, but it just kind of screams like, yeah, let's slap the Trackmania name on it and just reuse this engine and just get it out again.
But does it not feel like Trackmania?
Yeah, but Trackmania is a pretty simple game. You know,
I would liken it to like F-Zero Time Trials.
Yeah, that's a lot what it's like.
Like crazy levels, you're the only car on there, you're just trying to get to the end as fast as possible.
Yep, and you're racing
a ghost.
You
can actually play it for free on PC. If you have Steam or something like that, there's a pay version, but there's also a free version that you can play as much as you want.
Yep.
And it's fun, but I don't know if I'd pay $30 for a DS version of that.
No, I mean, I would
play it for free.
Yeah, I would highly recommend the PC version over this one.
Oh, but I was under the impression that a big draw of this too was like you have a level that kind of exploits the physics of the game, where you have to go to a certain speed or you're gonna fall off or stuff. Maybe that's more for the custom levels, but I mean, is that spirit kind of captured in the DS version, or is that lost?
Not really. See, the one mode they have in there is called platform mode, and from what I can tell, it's just you trying to make it through. It's kind of like an obstacle course, so you'll be going along and there'll be, you know, a hole. It's the same as the PC where, you know, there's, you'll have like a big, you know, an elongated hole in the track that you have to, you know, go around. But the thing is with platform mode, I mean, it's just one car out there. I mean, the thing is you can go as fast or as slow as you want. There's really no, there's really not much of a time limit there, so it doesn't really exploit anything. I mean, it's not doing anything too spectacular.
But there might be ramps, and you have to have a certain speed to get over them.
That,
so, I mean,
right.
Yeah.
I mean,
that
is
true. That's the sort of thing I watched Windy play when he was playing Trackmania. So that's what I think of when I think of Trackmania.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, for example, they have speed boost areas where you run over the arrow that's on the track and you get a speed boost. And
like F-Zero.
Yeah, exactly. And you kind of have to do it in. Yeah, the thing is, it kind of like a lot of the tracks look for the perfect run. Like you have to do things in a certain way to complete the track in the allotted time.
Sounds like a poor man's Monkey Ball or F-Zero.
In a way, yeah. I played through Killzone, and, I mean, I'm a big fan of shooters, so I think Killzone is great. I know Billy didn't seem to be too impressed with it when he was on here. He said, I believe he said it was really bro-y, was the phrase.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just, I know that Billy was talking about how, you know, it has a really, really good graphics engine, and it's a beautiful-looking game, but, you know, everything is like various colors of rust, which is completely true, but, you know, I mean, that's kind of true to what they wanted to do with the game, right? So, but, I mean, I'm really enjoying it. I haven't touched the multiplayer yet. What really impressed me about it is they have a lot of... They really vary the types of things you're doing in the game. It's not just like a corridor shooter where you're walking through, you know, kind of a shooting gallery. You do a lot of things like you have to, you know, you'll come through an area and, you know, clear out all the enemies, and then the next thing that you do will be, you know, hop into some anti-aircraft gun and shoot down planes, and then you hop out of that and, you know, you hop into a tank, and then, you know, you have to do all this kind of varied stuff. So they really keep it moving, and they really, the pace is really well done. The ending is kind of anticlimactic. It just kind of stops. I mean, you kill the bad guy at the end, but, you know, it's not really as epic.
Wait for the paid DLC ending.
Yeah. It's a bit, well, I heard they patched the controls for this.
Supposedly.
Have you noticed the difference, or have you updated it?
No. Well, that's the thing. See, that was weird, because when I got it in the mail, I actually got it, you know, I had the Amazon release day shipping, so they brought it in at like, I got it around noon. And so I put it in, you know, watched the intro, played the game when I was at lunch. And so, you know, I go back to work. I come back home, and there's already a patch for it. And I'm like, what the hell did they patch? I had the game for 4 hours, and they're already patching it. And supposedly, everybody's saying that they tweaked the controls, but I didn't really feel it. But then again, I'm probably not the best person to judge because I was playing it when they had the private multiplayer beta. So I kind of already knew the controls, you know, so I didn't really see anything either way.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, there's been a lot of talk about the controls, and I don't really see it. I've never really had a problem with the controls. I think the thing is, what you have to compensate for is your guns actually recoil. So if you're sitting, like, you can't just sit there with one of the machine guns and shoot at somebody and have your gun stay in a straight line. Your gun will actually kind of go off like proper recoil with a gun would, right? So you kind of have to
re-aim between shots.
Pretty much, yeah. Or like what I do is I do like kind of like burst shooting if I want to do headshots. So, like, instead of sitting there just holding down the trigger, trying to, like, you know, like you're spraying a hose of death, you know, and trying to line up your hose of death with somebody's head, you have to actually just sit there and, you know, kind of, like, burst the trigger, you know.
Yeah, I had to do that in Black, and I think Black kind of takes its recoil similarly, you know, carefully.
Yeah.
That you know, they were, like, really, really concerned with the accuracy of the gun models and how they work and what they sound like and how they feel. Mm-hmm. So...
yeah, Black would probably be very similar to Killzone in terms of what they were trying to achieve. But I really liked it. I think fans of shooters should check it out if they have a PS3 for sure.
So, Greg, what's going on with you in gaming?
I have some relatively happy news, actually. Just a few hours ago, one of the few notable virtual console releases in Europe for some time, Super Punch-Out!, just came out.
Oh, here, cool.
So I would assume that you can't be very far behind for the American market. And that's good. I played Super Punch-Out back in the day as a rental. And I got very, very far into it, but I didn't finish it. So I'm looking forward to sort of unfinished business with that at some point. Cause,
I've never touched that game, and I'd like to.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, very good. I mean, it's because there is more variety than in the original Punch-Out. You know, in the original Punch-Out, you've kind of got basically a few different characters and then they just vary on them. You know, even ones that are, you know, like Bull Bull and Sandman are kind of fundamentally similar and stuff like that. So there wasn't really that much variety. Whereas in this, there's definitely more. From what I can remember, and it is just like a giant boss rush, but it's really good for that, and I look forward to sort of getting reacquainted with that at some point. Although I might actually wait for the Japanese one because it won't be the dodgy PAL version.
Well, isn't that weird that Nintendo might actually be lining up their virtual console releases to promote a Wii disc release? Because there have been several opportunities for them to do that, and they've never
Smash
really...
Brothers didn't do it, yeah. Mario Kart, they didn't do it, because like Mario Kart 64 came out very early in Virtual Console's life, and then Super Mario Kart remains conspicuously absent.
I thought that was out.
No, Super Mario Kart is absolutely not out. I would have it if I did, because I never owned it.
I wouldn't download that anyway, but that's interesting.
I never owned Super Mario Kart, so I would kind of like to own it.
Blasphemy. Shame on you, Greg.
It was an expensive business back in the day. It's like, what? It always runs in split screen? That is complete. This is the level on which decisions were made when you were about 8 years old.
God, I forgot about that. Yeah, even in single player, it's always split screen.
This is bullshit.
F-Zero doesn't do that. F-Zero came out before, and it uses basically the same technology.
F-Zero does not have two player.
Yeah, I realize that, but Super Mario doesn't have one player.
this podcast hates Super Mario Kart, confirmed.
I just Worst never liked ever. The Super Nintendo version that much. Like, I think it's the only one with a decent battle mode. But
yeah, I love the battle mode, yeah.
The point is, you know, it's a kind of facile basis on which it was not purchased for very many pounds back in the day, and yeah. I would like to play it now to see what it's like. It is of a broader topic, obviously, as we get in Super Punch-Out, stuff like Super Mario Kart, so we still haven't got, pilot wings. for instance, again, you know, I mean, that was like such an early game, you would think we'd have that. You know, there's so many Super NES games that we haven't got. I mean, people talk about the FX chip ones and stuff, but, you know, I mean, F-Zero's there, they can emulate Mode 7, you know, so
yeah.
I don't really understand that at all.
Pilot Wings is a game I think that really has not aged well, and that might have something to do with it, but...
I doubt it. I don't know what it's about.
It could also be a Paradigm thing, because it was developed by Paradigm, and they
Was Super NES the version developed by Paradigm?
I'm pretty sure both Pilot Wings games
were Paradigm. I know for certain the N64 one. Like,
yeah.
Absolutely certain.
I think the Super Nintendo one was too.
Right.
But I'm not 100% sure, so that might be a red herring also. I really don't know.
I have no interest in the Super Nintendo version. I played the N64 one first, and then I saw the Super Nintendo one later at a friend's house.
It would be hard to go back.
What is this crap? I mean, so yeah. I mean, I'd love to see the 64 one, but
it's like this weird Mode 7 curio. But imagine playing a flight game with the D-pad. You know, I mean, like, imagine the stuff you're doing in Pilot Wings 64, you're doing the same stuff on Super Nintendo, but the controls are very stiff and obviously totally digital, and it's a pretty frustrating thing. It was a neat showcase, though, at the time. But
yeah, you know, that was
I wouldn't buy it, even if they did put it out on Virtual Console. The 64 one I would consider, because I think that's more fun.
That's kind of shocking that that's not there as well. Obviously.
Yeah,
that's
a launch title, even in America. Yeah,
I think that game would be one of the few to really benefit from the higher resolution that they put
I agree with that.
All right, well, Greg, what is this about Final Fantasy?
Well, yeah, so people may, if they're regular listeners, may know that I have never played a mainline Final Fantasy game, thanks to John, who, when he was reviews editor, had me review Final Fantasy Tactics. I can't say that I actually have never played a Final Fantasy game. But I haven't played the proper ones, as it were.
But you haven't played a good tactics game either.
The
PS1, the one for PS1 is.
Well, you know, it seemed good to me, but I'm a relative neophyte to it. That was thoroughly explained in the review. But you know, don't confuse not the best with not good. You know,
I played the first Tactics Advance, and
I think you gave it like a 7 or more, didn't you? I mean,
because it has nice production values, but that's one of the reviews where if I went back, I mean, I would probably go lower, because just the game just drags on, and anyway, unless they dramatically improved it on the DS sequel, then I would never want
to
play.
I can't speak to that, as you know. But but the point is, I haven't played any of the real Final Fantasy games, obviously, you know, sort of out of the loop with the PlayStation era stuff, and didn't play the Super NES ones. I played Chrono Trigger and Secret of Mana instead, basically. I was thinking about what would be the best one to start with. And so obviously you've got 3 and 4 on the DS, you've got all the ones on the GBA that I could go with, and basically I was thinking that maybe 6 Advance would be the best, because 6 is generally regarded as one of the best, if not the best. And apparently it's quite forgiving in the difficulty department, because 4 is meant to be quite hard, isn't it, for the DS?
Yeah, well, luckily you've got TYP here, and he's a real expert, so...
Yeah, because, you know, you were in the same boat, weren't you, TYP?
Absolutely. 6 months ago, I was like, I haven't played a Final Fantasy, I'm kind of proud of that, but maybe it's time. Maybe it's time. So I picked up Final Fantasy IV, and it is very difficult, but I didn't find it to be a problem. I mean, I'd never played a Final Fantasy game before, but I've obviously played other RPGs.
I've played very few other RPGs as well. I mean, for generally just like the Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana, and then like Mario ones. That's about it.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't played that many more than that. But I mean, it's hard, but it's hard in a way that's fun. It's hard to explain, but like some of the difficulty comes from very clever use of the battle mechanics. But it isn't like hard in the sense that it's really complicated. I mean, I would not want to play something like Final Fantasy Tactics, because I don't want to juggle all that crap. I didn't get that
those
impression
games
with
are
Final Fantasy.
Ridiculously complex, for sure.
Yeah, Final Fantasy IV is not a complex game, but it is a difficult game, and there is some grinding involved. Absolutely.
Yeah, see but that would
compared to
be
Dragon, but it's nowhere near Dragon Quest levels of grinding.
Yeah, that's
in my
I'm certainly not considering. I think Dragon Quest would be somewhere down the line if I were to get into Final Fantasy.
Right.
I would enjoy that. That would be the next stage.
Yeah. Dragon Quest, it's funny because Dragon Quest is typically easier than Final Fantasy because there's less strategy involved in the battle system. It's more about, is your level high enough to beat this guy? If not,
sure.
You need to go grind more. And because of that, it's easier, but it is more, there's more kind of busy work put into it in order to play the game.
Yeah, so that would be my chief concern. People, regular listeners, mm-hmm. are like, I have a high tolerance for pure difficulty. But yeah. it's the relative tedium aspect.
I think your skill level would make it fine for you to play to start with 4.
Absolutely.
FF6 is definitely a bit easier, and it looks like it's going to be a while before they make a DS remake, if at all.
Sure.
So the GBA version, I haven't played the GBA version of 6, but I've heard it's quite good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few issues. The localization is updated. It's sort of new, so it's a bit more full than the Super NES would have been. The soundtrack is not as good, basically, because the GBA sound hardware is not as good. But they do apparently do a reasonable job of kind of... So there's pluses and minuses with that. But and the other thing is that I can take my micro on the commute with me and play it, which I don't like taking my DS with me anywhere. Mainly because if I lost my micro, it was stolen or something by some crazy person.
They wouldn't even know what it was.
It wouldn't bother me because it's like I've got that functionality everywhere else, whereas if I lost my DS Lite, I would be quite peeved, shall we say.
Yeah.
So that's a factor as well. But pure game-wise, you know, I mean, 4 sounds obviously like it's a really excellent game. And, I mean, have you ever settled on which you prefer in an absolute sense, at 4 and 6?
I think gameplay-wise, I prefer 6. But story-wise, even though it's more conventional, part of me says I prefer 4 story because so the key difference between the two... aside from, you know, having different characters and whatnot, the key difference is in how structured it is. Because in Final Fantasy IV, the members of your party are determined by the progression of the story. So every hour or two, someone will leave the party, someone will join the party, and that means your battle tactics have to change. Mm-hmm. And so it tends to keep the gameplay more varied as you go through because, you know, through this part of the game, you're really reliant on magic. And then through this part, you have almost no magic and you have to carry a lot of healing items or you're going to really be in trouble. So it kind of goes back and forth. Sometimes you have this balance. Sometimes you have these kind of physically weak ninja or karate type characters who have special abilities that if you leverage them in interesting ways can, you know, that's how you would do well. So I like that. It kind of forces you to try all the characters and change your tactics as you go through. FF6 has a total of 14 characters that are playable, and by the end of the game, depending on some story choices that you make, you can have access to all 14 of them. So you just build a party of 4 people, and that's the other thing, the party size is smaller. So you go from 5 in FF4 up to 5. Could be as few as 1, depending on where you are in the story. But in FF6, you can always have basically 4 people in your party, and you choose. So you can always kind of stick with your favorite characters, and these other guys may be really interesting, but you never give them a chance, or you can drive yourself crazy if you try to keep them all leveled up all the time, or teach all the magic to all of them. So it's a much more open system, and it gives you a lot more choice. It's almost a little more like an American-style RPG, like Fallout in that sense, in that, you know, you can kind of choose what you want to do in battle, what kind of skills you want to focus on. But I think it takes away a little bit from the focused nature of it. So that's the main difference. And I like both. I have pros and cons for both. But gameplay-wise, I'd say that's the biggest difference between the two.
No, that's pretty informative.
Yeah, I'd say it's your call. I have not played 6, but I will tell you that since you like difficult games, when I played 4, I didn't grind maybe more than one or two levels if I really needed to, and it wasn't all the time. It was really, I mean, I enjoyed kicking and scratching to beat bosses, and if that's what you want, then it's a great difficulty.
I mean, if that's what
you.
The difficulty really is leveraged on, then that's not particularly unattractive.
And near the end, people complain that it gets really hard, but I think a lot of people forget you can run away from battles, and in Final Fantasy IV, at least on the DS, you want to run away from battles if it's not smart to fight. So keep that in mind.
Very few RPGs actually, you know, are difficult enough that you might actually want to do that. So
yeah, I mean, running away is usually
vestigial.
I respect the
difficulty very much. Yeah, I think you should start with 4, Greg. I mean, I think you should play both, obviously.
Yeah,
but
that is kind of the question we're talking about, is what to start with as well, not so much just
and,
like
you know,
one
4
or
is probably easier to get.
Yeah, so that is something I've encountered. That is very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 6 on GBA is a bit difficult to find.
It's probably like 2007, but it's like gold dust.
That's exactly the kind of game that, you know, the people that really wanted it bought it, and then it just disappeared, and they probably did a split second run.
It was a very late GBA game.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that's
it's pretty much
it.
The swan song.
So I think you should play 4. If you like it, you can go through the effort to track down 6 on GBA, or you could maybe wait and see if they're going to announce remakes of 5 and 6. I mean, you know, it's weird because they announced Dragon Quest 4, 5, and 6 pretty much all at the same time.
They did.
The DS remakes.
Yeah.
And with 4, they did 3, which I don't recommend, really.
No, that does not sound...
And then after that was out, and that was a pretty big success, then they announced 4. And obviously, there's kind of more... There's a little more effort being put into these remakes than there are the Dragon Quest ones, and they're more cinematic games. They're a little more difficult, I think, to translate. I mean, they did voiceover work and all kinds of shit for 4. It's a really impressive game on DS. Really, really impressive. Whereas Dragon Quest 4 and 5 are pretty straightforward. The graphics engine is nice, but other than that, they pretty much look like Dragon Quest, you know. So, yeah, there you go. There's your answer.
There's your segue.
Exactly. So for my new business, I have been playing Dragon Quest V on DS, and I'm still pretty early on. I found that it gets off to a pretty slow start. It's interesting. Dragon Quest is not really a series that I think of as being something that holds your hand through a bunch of storytelling or, you know, some kind of unusual... scripted events where you don't have a whole lot of control over where you go next. I mean, typically in Dragon Quest, they kind of just throw you into a town and say, well, go for it. You know, go find the next cave. It's somewhere around here. And you have the freedom to go out and grind and buy new weapons and kind of do what you want to do and do it at your own pace. Whereas Dragon Quest V is very scripted for the first 5 hours at least. In fact, I'm still in the really heavily scripted stuff. It feels more like the start of Final Fantasy VII, you know, where you start out in this very linear kind of handheld experience where you're in a small area and you know you can't really explore until you finally get out of the big city, and now it looks like Final Fantasy. Now you can go wherever you want to, etc. But yeah, Dragon Quest V, I'm still waiting for it to get to that point. I can't really say much about it yet because it feels just like Dragon Quest IV did, except a lot more linear and a lot more storyline based so far. Suffice it to say that the main character in Dragon Quest V undergoes a lot more character development than you've seen before in the series. And by that, I mean he undergoes some character development. Because he actually has, like, personal relationships with other characters, and those relationships undergo various stresses and life-changing events. And you've never really seen that. Like, the main characters in Dragon Quest is always pretty much just a blank avatar for you. You may have a name, or they may vaguely refer to you as the prince of this one kingdom, but...
The hero?
You know, yeah, you're basically the hero. And in this one, I mean, obviously you can change the name, but, like, you start the game out and you're, like, 3 years old. You can't even read signs. You go up to signs and press the A button and it says, you haven't learned to read yet.
That's great.
And you're basically being dragged from one town to the next by your father. And then after two or three sort of mini quests with him, basically he gets killed. And that's early in the game, so I'm not spoiling much. But he gets killed, and then you get enslaved, and then like 10 years pass by, and then the next time you see your character, you're kind of, you know, like a teenager, and you've been a slave for most of your life, and you're trying to escape slavery. So that is already way more character development than they've ever done in this series. Do I necessarily like that? Well, I think it's fine, but at the same time, I'm kind of anxious to get to like the real Dragon Quest gameplay, because I haven't really gotten there yet. So we'll see. All the stuff about monster training, the proto Pokemon elements, that hasn't come in yet at all, and I've been playing for like 7 hours, so I can't comment on that yet. The other game I played this week is Bit Trip Beat for WiiWare, and probably a lot of our listeners have heard about this game. Maybe they've downloaded it for themselves, but it's pretty much Pong from hell.
Why from hell?
Yeah, well, because it's like Pong, except you're not playing against the computer or another opponent. You're playing a level of Pong. So what it is instead of one ball being bounced back and forth from one side of the screen to the other, your paddle is on the left side of the screen, and there's just like hundreds and hundreds of balls coming in from right to left. And you're just trying to intercept. I mean, they don't come faster than you could possibly get to them, because they're based on the beat of this song. So it's very sequential. You hit this one ball, then you can hit the next one, then you can hit the next one. But they're coming pretty much nonstop. And so the goal is just to keep any of them from getting past you. And so the level is designed so that it's throwing all kinds of different balls. They behave in different ways. Some of them bounce on the floor and the ceiling. Some just fly straight at you. Some kind of move around in squiggly patterns. Some just blink, which is distracting, and it's hard to focus on them. And a lot of the gameplay, a lot of the challenge put in the gameplay seems to be focused around the idea that things are hard to focus on, or it's hard to discern the foreground from the background. So I'm not sure if I'm really a big fan of that kind of challenge being put in the game, but it is really well done, and I like it a lot, actually. You control it by twisting the remote. You hold it NES style, and you just kind of twist the remote forwards and backwards and move the paddle up and down. And that's very accurate. It works really well. You don't have to think about it very much. And I really like it. Like I said, I'm not a big fan of, as you play better, the backgrounds get more and more intricate. And as they do, it starts to become difficult to actually see what the fuck's going on.
Yeah.
But I guess that's their way of making it more challenging. But I do really like the game, and it's only $6.
How big is it? How big file size?
Oh, it's like 317 blocks, I think. It's pretty damn big.
That's a fridge cleaner.
Chubby. It is a fridge cleaner.
Yeah, for sure.
And at first I was like, you know, it only has three songs in it. I'm like, how could it be taking up that much space with three songs? But the songs are actually really long, because they're the length of the level, and the levels are like 10 minutes long each. And then the other thing is the graphics. They look very 8-bit, but like I said, the better you do as you build up these really long combos, the graphics actually get more complex. And over time, you start to think, okay, well, I'm starting to think maybe this can justify its file size because of all the weird stuff going on. And the music isn't strictly 8-bit. It's kind of 8-bit melody with some more advanced stuff going on in the rhythm and, you know, some of the instrumentation as you do better. And then if you start to do really poorly and you're like on the brink of getting a game over, everything goes to black and white. It looks like, it looks like an old Pong screen. It's all in black and white, and at that point, the music from your TV speakers stops, and all you hear are sounds coming out of your Wii remote, which is really lo-fi, and it sounds like a Pong arcade game, or even a Pong home game. So, and that's nice, because it actually removes all the distractions, and it helps you focus purely on hitting the balls.
So it's a kind of natural balancing thing in terms of the lower end and the upper end.
That's right. That's right. And if you're in this black and white mode and you hit, say, 10 balls without letting anything go by, then it upgrades you back into the medium level. So then you can keep going. So
it sounds like a bit of a bit of a Space Invaders Extreme type kind of experience in terms of that interaction audio and the gameplay, which is really nice. I really like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a chance, you should really check this out. And just looking at, apparently this Bit Trip thing is supposed to be a franchise on WiiWare, and I was just thinking, how awesome would it be if they could make a kind of music-based 8-bit Mario platformer game for WiiWare?
Kind of like Donkey Kong Jungle Beat?
Yeah, 8-bit Donkey Kong Jungle Beat.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely could see them doing that with this technology that they have and the kind of gameplay that they're apparently interested in. So I'm looking forward to see what they do next with it. And my last little bit of new business is I became an uncle today for the first
time. Uncle Johnny.
Oh, congratulations, yeah. Johnny.
Uncle Johnny. Yeah, it's a weird feeling. I mean, talking to my parents and realize they're now grandparents. And yeah, my sister, she's doing well. The baby was almost 3 months premature, so we were really worried. This was all kind of unexpected. Just in the past few days, it's been developing, and they decided that she needed to go ahead and have the baby. So it's been stressful on me, but the baby was born this morning, and so far everything looks really good, and I think everybody's going to be fine.
Now, is the kid still like in the intensive care or anything like that?
He's in the neonatal, all that crap. But he's breathing on his own and appears to be pretty healthy, all things considered. So
very cool.
But he'll be in the hospital for the next couple months, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, he's a lucky baby.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, modern technology is, that's one of the things that we've licked pretty well as premature babies. Some pretty amazing advancements in that in the past few decades. So yeah, I think he's going to be fine.
Good.
I'm hopeful. Anyway, if I seem distracted tonight, that's part of probably why. Anyway, that's new business, and we're going to take a break now. We'll be back with the second part of our Eternal Darkness discussion. We are back for Retroactive number 3, Eternal Darkness, part 2. And
First Blood part 2, Rambo.
<right. laughs> Yeah, so, you know, we're kind of going to wrap up our discussion of Eternal Darkness here, and it's a big game. Unfortunately, I didn't get to complete it because of other distractions this week. But, you know, I think I will try to kind of keep it around and keep playing through it bit by bit, because I would like to kind of go all the way through it.
Well, I certainly would, because I haven't done it before.
yeah, you should, because the end stuff is good. But before we get into kind of the later part of the game, I kind of wanted to get caught up with what TYP and especially John thought, because TYP, have you played it recently?
No, I haven't, but I spent some time last night watching some YouTube videos and the like to get a refresher course on the game.
Yeah, I appreciate that effort.
No, I mean, like, I played it 3 or possibly 4 times way back when. So, I mean, I played this game a lot.
You're well steeped in the lore.
I was well steeped, and I'd forgotten a lot of it, but I mean, I certainly played a lot of it, and the weird thing about Eternal Darkness for me was that I basically learned about it because I was on staff here at Planet GameCube.
Well, and, I was an evangelist. Let's just say I was a cheerleader for it back around 2000. Between 2000 and 2002.
I think that's the reason why I could remember your name back when I read the stuff. back when I read the song, the Eternal Darkness guy, basically.
Yeah, because it's weird because I brought that with me when I joined the staff because I was already.
Yeah,
because
it goes way back, doesn't it, with the N64 stuff.
I wrote a bunch of stuff at the Informant for an Eternal Darkness when it was an N64. Game, and so when I joined Planet GameCube in 2000, there was some pretty heavy rumors that it was going to get moved up to GameCube, and so, you know, once that started to solidify, I was tapped for previews, and, you know, we interviewed Dennis in 2001 at E3 and all that stuff, so I kind of came in with that under my belt, and I think that all that Eternal Darkness stuff I had done was part of what made Billy interested in me as a staff member. So, yeah, I mean, that was part of my identity early on, was I was like the Eternal Darkness guy.
Yep.
So. Yeah, so like I stumble in E3 2001, and here I am just sort of sitting there like the awkward young non-journalist sitting there with like 20 other staff members talking about Eternal Darkness. And like,
that's
around
when we
table.
Were outside, right?
Yeah, we're outside, like sitting in like a semicircle. It was it was kind of strange for me, but
it was a very unusual interview, and he must have felt kind of weird in that setting, because normally in an interview you wouldn't bring 12 people to the interview.
Yeah,
only one guy.
It was almost like he was the guru on top of the hill.
Jesus breaking fish and bread.
Exactly.
Here's some information, kids.
I know.
Yeah. Spread it around.
That's kind of weird.
There's like, enough for everybody.
Listen, my children.
Well, he talks about, you know, back in the old days of movies, you know, they didn't have all this newfangled technology. And, you know, so in a way it was kind of like that. I mean, he's talking about the old days, you know. So, anyway, but about the actual game itself, I always liked the story. I thought it was really neat. And I had never played Resident Evil before, so I really didn't have any of that. You know,
baggage.
In my background, you know,
baggage is a good word for it.
Like Carl's like, oh, I played Resident Evil 4. Like, I don't know anything about Resident Evil. I've only heard of it. You know, I don't know what the gameplay is. So that was very healthy. I came into it really just not knowing what to expect, and I really enjoyed it. I can't say I'm a huge fan of the combat. To me, it feels a little clunky, but nowhere near, say, like Prince of Persia levels of clunkiness. I remember I love the original Prince of Persia on GameCube and Xbox and PS2, but the combat there was just like uncomfortable. Here it was okay, but I still feel like it's a little tankish.
Yeah, I just wish you could turn around quicker. That was a big problem that I had. And I mean, I did a lot of times when you're fighting, especially a group of monsters, there's a lot of hit one, run away to the other side of the room.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of running around in circles, like to get behind them.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, I mean, just look at the gaze. Maybe you guys haven't gotten to the final boss, but I was watching videos of it. I mean, that's what you're doing the entire time for the final boss. You take a hit, run away. Take a hit, run away. Yep. I mean, it's
very gamey, the combat, I think. Whereas a lot of the rest of the game is not very gamey. You know,
exactly. Mm-hmm. It takes you out of the element. It makes you realize, oh, I'm playing a game.
It can, and unfortunately, I think to jump ahead a little bit, but as you get deeper in the game and it gets more difficult in the second half, your combat abilities don't change that much. A lot of times you're kind of using the same old swords and slow guns, and so what does change is your access to magic. And what happens is you start to get really reliant on magic because the enemies are getting more difficult. They tend to be more aligned against you in terms of the colors. And the strategy for beating a lot of these enemies, a lot of it boils down to, you know, get off this magic spell in the nick of time and then go run around for 30 seconds until your magic meter fills up again so you can cast another spell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is really gamey and kind of unfortunate. But just really quickly to go back to the comparison to Resident Evil, which at the time most people were making, as we talked about last week, compared to Resident Evil combat, Eternal Darkness was really graceful. So we considered it like a really nice improvement over kind of our expectations.
Yeah.
But I think going back and looking at it now, it does seem extremely clumsy, and it's probably the part of the game that has aged the worst. But at the time, the combat was considered, like, really kind of top-notch, you know, shit.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, this is a really nice improvement over the stuff we're used to in
this kind of game. The extent that I played it, for the most part, the game was not so leveraged on it that it kind of exposed the cracks. And now, later in the game, would you say it does more?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As it gets harder, I think it does.
It gets more drawn out. The combat gets more drawn out. The use of the magic spells gets more drawn out. You feel like you have to cast a spell before you do anything, and it's just it slows things down. One of the things I wrote down.
I mean, I think I played until Kareem. I think the guy with two swords. I played until his chapter, and one of the things that becomes evident at that point is when you're fighting enemies, they make things harder just by throwing more enemies at you. Not by really changing anything up. It's just like instead of fighting 5 enemies, you're fighting 15.
Well, you know, part of that I think is to the game's credit, because the reason it's more difficult when they throw more enemies at you is that they do all attack you at the same time. They don't take turns.
Yeah, it's kind of cheap though.
Whereas in a lot of games, you know, throwing more enemies at you would just mean that the battles take longer because it takes you just have to churn through more enemies. Mm-hmm. In Eternal Darkness, it is actually more difficult to deal with 5 zombies instead of 1.
True.
Because they'll surround you and they, you know what, you notice one thing, like even if you're doing like a finishing move or casting a spell, in Eternal Darkness, nothing waits for your animations to finish. They will interrupt the shit out of you. Mm-hmm. So you really have to get to a place of safety to do something that takes any kind of time to get off. And so you have to think about positioning and proximity to a group of enemies and where they are in their animation cycling. And that's what makes it difficult. You know, it's not tedious so much as it's just harder to manage when you have all those things to, multiple enemies at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You're still fighting the same things the same way, though. I got kind of tired of it. Like, that's where it kind of bogs down for me, is where you'll get to a particular area that's kind of like the end of a particular stage, where it's just like the same enemies just tossed in there.
I think we touched on this last week, didn't we? Mm-hmm. I think probably you and I, John, are speaking about the same part. I agree. It's just the combat and the enemy design, all that, is just not interesting and varied enough to sustain that.
Yeah.
Really, that kind of like, you know, sort of waves of enemies. And that's not something that really plagues the game in the stages that I've played. But
I think there are only maybe 7 kinds of enemies in the game.
Yeah.
That I'm thinking, I'm kind of almost counting them off right now. I can only think of 7, maybe 8. Mm-hmm. And we're talking, it's a pretty lengthy game. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of combat. Mm-hmm. So, it really could have used a lot more of that. But I mean, 2 Human only has like 3 enemies in it. So.
Yeah. I think in a way, though, the...
count your blessings.
I think in a way, the amount of enemies is kind of tied to the combat, because if you had more varied enemies, to make it interesting, you would have to have more ways to kill them. And you really don't have that too
much. Yeah, well, again, I mean, you could have based the enemy design and the combat design around the fact that, you know, like for different enemies you'd have to kind of kill them in a different way with regards to the dismemberment angle, but it didn't seem like that was like fully exploited. It was kind of more of a little fun.
It's more of a thing for you to, it's more of a like a playground
experimentation
for you,
sort of thing, rather than like a design fundamental, like a design pillar.
Well, what I thought was funny about that is I remember when Dead Space was released, they made a big deal out of how you could, you know, cut limbs off of monsters. It's like you were able to do that in Eternal Darkness in, you know, 2000.
But it's a much more integral part of the gameplay in Dead Space.
Yeah.
In Dead Space, it really matters what order you dismember enemies.
Okay.
And they attack differently. A lot of them are still extremely dangerous even after you've knocked off, you know, even 2 or 3 limbs in some cases. They're still dangerous. Mm-hmm. And in Dead Space, a lot of times, knocking the head off is the least useful thing to do, whereas in Eternal Darkness, you almost always want to knock the head off first.
Pretty much.
Because then he can't see. So then he's still dangerous because he'll flail around or whatever, but he might hit some of the other enemies and he can't follow you as easily, which gives you a chance to run away and recharge magic and cast a spell.
Yeah.
So, and you notice that the way they deal with that is that the most difficult enemy has 3 heads.
Yeah,
so, John, I mean, from your notes on the parts that you played through, what else were your kind of initial impressions? We're still catching up with you, I guess, since you weren't here last week.
Yeah, let me see. I'll just kind of go through and peruse them. I really like the graphics. I liked how the graphics, they aren't too flashy, but they have some really detailed texture work in there, I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, they really focused on making the environment very moody. And also, what always impressed me about this game is the kind of historical detail that went into every single part of the game. Like, everything from, you know, kind of like the tombs that you move through, and there's a lot of, like, background story that they didn't really have to necessarily put in there, but they kind of wanted... I always think of it as a very well-crafted... If I could use a phrase, I would call it a well-crafted game. You know, they really put a lot of work into it.
Yeah. Also, on the presentation side, it's one of those rare first-party published games that had widescreen support at the time. I think F-Zero GX is one of the only other ones I could think of, and of course,
of Rare's games did.
Oh yeah, Rare's games would, because they did on N64.
Even going back to N64,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but of course, the common factor being that the first party published games that had widescreen support were not developed by Nintendo.
Right.
You know, I think it's just, I think it kind of it does benefit from it playing, actually, because, you know, just having that more expansive kind of view. Even though the environments are quite obviously claustrophobic a lot of the time, it's still just, it's more cinematic, more sort of a broad view is nice. Although, the problem, in a way, is that quite a lot of the cutscenes are not formatted for widescreen, so they end up like in a letterbox. They're like a 4:3 widescreen letterbox within a widescreen. So it's like this almost like the Super NES Star Fox little thing in the middle. and then some of the cutscenes are like FMV, and it looks terrible.
Yeah,
it's
really artifacted.
It's so pretty bad compression.
Yeah.
They're well made. In terms of the direction and the art and everything,
the FMV is well done,
but the technically how it was put into the disc was pretty bad.
Yeah, it looks like they were still concerned about shoehorning it onto a cartridge. You know, I mean, like, I don't know. I doubt that's the problem. But
I mean, maybe it was, and they just never changed it.
No, it's not that bad.
Go back and play Resident Evil 2 on N64. You'll see nasty FMV in that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, it's amazing that it was there at all. But
I kind of felt like a lot of the FMVs were almost looked like they used the same assets as in the in-game models, and I'm like, why do they have FMV then? Is it because there's special effects they can't do?
I don't know, like, because the main FMV ones I can remember is like when Pius is communicating with the god, he looks more rounded. He does look. He's a little less blocky, but yeah, I mean, it's a fair point in the sense that he doesn't look so much better.
The gods themselves are rendered. They're using a lot of effects that the GameCube couldn't have really handled.
Yeah,
very much.
Sure.
And that depends
a
bit on which god you choose in the beginning. So
yeah,
it depends. I mean, you may not the path you chose may not be quite as impressive in the FMVs because the FMVs are mostly Pius talking to the god of your choice.
Yeah.
So. Zelototh is pretty cool looking.
Other things, what made me laugh from some of the comments in the forums was I also got burned by not saving my game. It made me laugh because I realized how much I rely on having a hard drive in my consoles now, or just having storage, period. And, I mean, I just assume that games autosave now, and I don't even think about it. And so I played for an hour, and I got killed. And I was like, oh, well, it'll just start over again. Oh, wait a minute.
And terrible.
I was like, burn.
As someone who doesn't play any PC games, really, it's expected that it's going to be an autosave, or it's going to say, do you want to save now? Or there's going to be a save point. I mean, that's just sort of how I grew up. You know?
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean,
or
to
when
that
you die,
point,
it says, "Do you want to save now?" You know, like in Zelda.
Yeah, yeah. So, but to that point, I mean, when you consider, we talked a little bit last week about what Nintendo's involvement would be and things like that, and it's just like I can't believe they didn't demand that it was handled differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because that would seem to me to be one of the things that Nintendo would be like the kind of thing that they would intervene on, because I think. People say that they kind of were the ones that forced that weird continue system in Wario World for GameCube, mm-hmm. which was developed by Treasure, which is kind of broken and silly. But the point is, it indicates that that is the kind of thing that they're concerned with. And it just, I mean, it's such an issue. I mean, I could
surely an oversight.
Yeah, I guess so, but I mean, it is actually, in sort of Nintendo's supervisory capacity, quite a failure of theirs, I think.
Absolutely.
I mean, it really is
amazing. I can understand why, you know, if you set aside Nintendo's involvement, I can see why it's that way. And Silicon Knights started as a PC developer, and, you know, Legacy of Kain: Blood Omen, they developed it for PS1, so this wasn't their first console game, you know? But I am pretty sure on the PS1 version of Legacy of Kain that it is like Eternal Darkness. Basically, it doesn't tell you to save, but you can save anywhere.
Yeah, I can't see that being an oversight. Somebody thought that was a good idea at the time.
Yeah, the other thing is, it could have been a transition from the N64 cartridge system, where it probably would have just saved to the ROM. Mm-hmm. And going to GameCube, where you have an external save medium with a memory card. So it could have been something that got caught in the console transition as they moved
over. That's a good point. Yeah, because it would have had to be different.
One thing I want to say about the save system, I think maybe I posted about this, I'm not sure. But most people complain, like, I got screwed because I forgot to save. Well, one time I got screwed because I did save.
Yeah, save in a sort of tight spot, and then you're stuck.
Exactly. I saved in a very tight spot. I think the first time I played through the game was on the hardest path, not knowing it, where I didn't have the healing spell for a while. And I saved when I was pretty low on health and pretty low on sanity because, like, oh, geez, I'm going to go into this big room, there'll be a lot of monsters. Now, what happened was, when you see a monster, you lose some sanity. Well, I didn't have any sanity left, so I would lose life.
Well,
and I think it was literally impossible.
Were you in?
I don't remember. This was 4 years ago.
If you're playing with I guess Maya is her name, she has that amulet that recharges your health 3 or 4, maybe 10 times. So you get pretty liberal use of it, and that recharges your sanity. And then the next chapter is Anthony, and he's slowly turning into a zombie. So I died while I was playing with him, but he immediately revives because he's already undead.
He's basically
invincible, yeah. Because I was really worried in that chapter. I'm like, shit, I don't have the magic to do recover yet, and they didn't give me an item. So when I fight this big kind of mid-boss, I'm kind of screwed if I don't beat him. And sure enough, I died, and I'm like, damn it. And then I saw him, like, rise back up from the ground. So they try to prevent that from happening. So I'm a little surprised that you got in that situation.
Well, I think what happened was I probably was in that the level where they have that revive, but I probably really wasted it. I was probably pretty damn bad at the game at the beginning. And
if you were on the harder path as well.
And I'm on the hard path. So I used up maybe I had one left. But the point is, I didn't have enough life for my skill level to love life plus healing items to survive. I wound up rewinding to the last previous chapter or two chapters ago, whatever the last save file I hadn't overwritten was, because I couldn't. And then after that, I basically wound up saving at the beginning of every chapter and then using that save state, you know, not writing over that one and saving in the second slot.
That's a very PC-style kind of save management.
but I shouldn't have to figure that out as a
yeah,
coach.
Yeah, no,
I agree. It's kind of badly done. But, all right, well, as far as the later parts of the game, like I said, I didn't get to the end. I played through Paul Luther's chapter, which is kind of, I guess, about two-thirds of the way through the game. And it's when you finally get the Paragon rune, and you at that point you essentially have all the magic spells, and you have your choice of different power levels. So from there on, magic becomes a much bigger part of the gameplay because they kind of expect you to use all the spells that you have at your disposal, mm-hmm. and they're going to throw enemies at you that you know you're not going to beat by going in there and just hacking with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where the difficulty really starts to ramp up, and in that chapter with Paul Luther, there's a point where you walk into a room and there are two of the really big Hulk enemies, and they're fighting. There are two different colors and they're fighting each other, and the dominant color, you know, depending on your path, the dominant color kills the other one, and then he turns towards you, and he's like the color that you're weak against, and that battle is brutal, and you have to beat him to move on through the game, basically. At least I think you do. He's definitely in the way. Possibly you could run around him, but that enemy is really tough, and I died there 3 or 4 times. And finally, the only way I could beat him was to enchant my crossbow and unload into his face until I ran out of ammo. And he finally died with, like, my last crossbow bolt. But, man, I tried several different strategies on him, and he was tough, and I thought, man, this game is not playing around anymore. Like, they expect you to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's one thing I want to say about when you die. You know, for such a sort of atmospheric game, and you've got the insanity effects and all that, the actual moment of death and the game over screen is pitiful.
It's so boring.
It's like you get this weak, terrible, weak little sort of bubum jingle as you die, which is barely up in the sound mix at all, and then you collapse, and then you get that laughable skull with the eyes in on the book, the still image of that. It's pathetic.
Yeah, it really is.
I just can't believe it's so well done, the rest of the game, and that is like cheesy and just weak ass.
You know,
with this whole save system stuff and the atmosphere of the game, it could be sort of legitimately terrifying, the thought of dying, if it were not for sort of being comedically undermined.
I just thought
that was really sad, actually.
I mean, there's so many things they could have done. Like, they could have had, you know, issued a blood-curdling scream, or maybe, like, sound like you're coughing up blood.
Yeah, you're not going to have, like, you know, the Resident Evil stuff where, like, you know, you get chainsawed to death.
You are dead.
You are dead.
Considering the whole Lovecraft style of the game, you would think that dying would be, that something somewhat more horrific would happen to you when you die.
Instead, you have
this zombie who just kind of, like, clubs you and you fall over, and then it fades away. It's like, really? I mean,
yeah, it's so bad.
I'm supposed to be terrified out of my mind here. I'm so scared of this, of these things, that I'm going crazy. And yet, the way it kills me is it's just sort of a love tap, and you fall over.
Well, at the same time, maybe they're going for realism there, though. It's like, if you were to die in that situation from someone hitting you, you'd probably just fall over and die.
It's just, it's thoroughly incongruous as far as I'm concerned.
Alright.
Yeah,
because everything else is so overdone, and
everything else is very much, you know, well, you could call it overwrought if you want, but it's, you know, they've put the effort in, it's atmospheric, it's, you know, and then that is kind of like they just phoned it in.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Well, okay, so in terms of what happens in the last part of the game, too, IP, I know you posted something in the forums about what you thought of sort of the last chapter. TYP posted in the forums, I recall being disappointed with the final part of the game. Instead of the giant battle I had anticipated, I was running around a confusing building, essentially pushing switches. Yeah, I guess there's a boss battle, but it felt anticlimactic, especially after the buildup of the subterranean city was done so well.
Yeah, so I don't agree with that person at all. it's bullshit. But what I will say is about around like when you play as Edward and you first really go into the city, and it's just you're wandering around this giant area. You're dealing with these enemies that like you really just sort of want to ignore, and you get lost really easily, and it goes on for too long, and then you do it again with Alex, and it just feels like it's rehashed, especially with Alex, because you've already done it. Yeah, and maybe I'm just biased against it or something, but I found it to be really annoying, because up until that point, you're playing with lots of different characters, you're doing really different things, even if it's in the same like setting, that's, you know, it's a lot later, a lot of things have changed, or maybe something about, you know, the person you're playing with makes it a lot different, you know, like Cathedral. How many times were you in the Cathedral? But it felt pretty different every time.
Yeah.
But like Alex's chapter just sort of felt like a rehash. It felt like they were just sort of drawing it out.
I can see that, and it makes sense a little bit in that Edward's chapter and her chapter take place relatively close together in the timeline compared to a lot of the other stage revisiting.
Sure.
But you know, I think every location in the game is used at least twice with two different characters. So there's a very fine balance there. Like, you can, I mean, that could be seen as kind of just lazy, or you're just trying to reuse all your assets so you don't have to make more stuff. But I think it does work in terms of the story, and I think they also do generally a nice job of making these places feel different when you go back. Like, if you think about the difference in the temple between Maya, which is like the first real chapter of the game, and then when you go back with Edward Lindsay and it's more like Indiana Jones style, like, not only are you going to different parts, you go deeper into the temple in some sense, and the puzzles are different, and your weapons are totally different, but also the lighting is different because it's happening during the day with Edward. And so as you run through the upper levels of the temple, it really feels different. And I think some of the traps are in different places. So, I mean, it's not 100% successful. You are still going through some of the same hallways. But I think, yeah, and the cathedral is probably the best case of where they really dramatically change it each time you go there. But I can see why, you know, that the necropolis or whatever it is underneath the mansion is, yeah, it is pretty much the same both times you go there, I guess. And you sort of go there with Maximilian, but it's really just the
it's kind of a fine sort of line to walk in terms of, I think people, you kind of like the idea of sort of getting glimpses of things and then coming back later. But, I mean, if you're literally going to cover the same ground rather than kind of like a little, and then you really expand on that later.
Yeah. You fight the same enemy in the same place, and you use them with the... kill him with the same strategy.
I think, we got one forum post from Drew MG. He says, one of the things I really enjoyed about Eternal Darkness was how you get to see the same story take place over the course of hundreds of years through the eyes of so many different people. The story was a great little puzzle that filled in slowly throughout time. And I get, that's the thing. I mean, I think if it's done right, where you kind of have these glimpses and stuff, you don't really think of it as, you know, oh, they're just reusing the assets and it's, you know, regurgitated, or they're padding the game. You think of it maybe in a narrative context, and it's kind of filling things in, it's a bit non-linear and stuff. Whereas if it's literally the same and you're covering so much of the ground, that kind of just gives way to, yeah, the game part of it kind of starts to dominate in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, To change gears a little bit and go back to the insanity effects that are so associated with this game, I unfortunately, in the time I played since last week, I haven't really seen any new ones because I mentioned last week I had just gotten the Mantarok rune, and once I get that, I have that regeneration spell, and when you use it with Mantarok, you're not going to run out of sanity, basically. even on the green path, you're just not. So I haven't really had anything to speak of since that time, just because I tend to use that spell quite a bit. But Pale said, in the forums, Pale, this is Mike Gammon, he posted, my favorite insanity effect by far is the controller disconnected one. I think the effectiveness of this was amplified by the fact that Eternal Darkness came out at the same time as the Wavebird, I think the same day. And as such, it was one of the first games I played using it. That left the door open for me to be really stressed out when he saw this effect. So... yeah, it's a great point, and it's, I don't know that it was really intentional on the part of Silicon Knights. They probably didn't have a whole lot of insight into the Wavebird during the game's development, but it did kind of work out nicely. And again, that's one that really goes back to Psychomantis, which they were very much inspired by in Metal Gear Solid, because he played with your controller. I think that's a good one.
Yeah, I guess it kind of just... I guess the point with the Wavebird is it just kind of helps bridge the disbelief in terms of that your controller could be disconnected. I mean, you know, if you're holding the controller in your hands and you know from the sort of tension in the cord it's connected, that kind of makes it a little harder to buy into this.
Actually, people don't realize this, but this insanity effect was actually aped a couple years later by Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles. I don't know if anybody gets that joke, but yeah, that game was notorious for the GameCube GBA link cables being pulled out of GBAs, and once it did, you were kind of screwed because it messed up the game for everybody else.
I remember that.
All right, so relating to the insanity effects, Brood War is posted in the forum. My big problem with Eternal Darkness is the sanity meter, as it allows you to know instantly if anything you see on screen is a sanity effect. That takes any surprise out of anything the game can do to you the entire game, and it completely nullifies the point of the sanity effects. Also, let's say you play through the game with a sanity meter intentionally left empty, which he thinks is the most enjoyable way to play the game. Then you have to deal with an endless barrage of women and babies crying, which is just too obnoxious to deal with the entire game. I think he has a point about the sanity meter.
Absolutely. I mean, to say completely nullifies or, you know, any any surprise is probably a little too far. But yeah, I mean, it's a very sound point that just, you know, things that are meant to be kind of like kind of play on uncertainty, and you're not that, you know, he's not completely undermined, but significantly undermined at least by the fact that you've got a little meter that kind of tells you when to expect it. I mean, it's... Mm-hmm.
Well, the one way they get around that is by hiding the meter. You know, the meters don't show on the screen all the time. You can always pause and look at them. But I think because they fade away, if your sanity hasn't been affected in the last few seconds by an enemy or something, that gives them the chance to do something and you not immediately realize it's because your sanity's too low, unless you just hit start and look at it, right? Yeah. But in the case of controller disconnected, maybe you hit start and it won't actually do anything. So.
Well, another issue is if your sanity is low, it won't always do its anti effect. So there is still a little bit of this, you know, second guessing the game. Like, is this a sanity effect? Is this a sanity effect? So it still works.
I think that's
level.
My point, that it's too much to say that it takes any surprise out of it. But there's no doubt that it does. It is, as far as the insanity sort of fact is kind of, it is an elegant way of kind of doing things. I mean, maybe there would be an argument to say, to actually make the meter essentially, like, you would never see it. You would kind of, if they sort of, you'd have to redesign it, so obviously, but...
Yeah, like some sort of on-screen HUD or something.
You never had an explicit meter, but you knew that you still had to, like, finish off the enemies to kind of stop this from happening.
Mm-hmm. Like blood dripping on the screen or something like that. Like,
yeah, just to maybe somehow make it a little more subtle, a little more elegant. You know,
they kind of do that anyway with the camera twisting to the side, and you do get blood dripping from the screen and stuff. But
people start muttering to themselves, you know, right? This is, you know, there's nothing here. No, you know, they start muttering too sometimes, depending on the
character.
Sometimes
you just hear like weird, this low level of weird chanting and shit in the background. It's pretty weird.
But that, like I said, maybe those kinds of indicators might have been, if you beef them up a little, might have been all you needed as far as the sanity meter.
I have a feeling that at some point in development, that was all that they were providing. And the sanity meter, it feels like a concession to Nintendo. It feels like the kind of thing where Nintendo would come in and say, look, we really like these sanity effects. We don't want to tie your hands here, but we think people are going to get really frustrated if they don't realize why these things are happening.
Although it disappoints me if that were true, that they would do that and not fix the save system.
Yeah.
Out of
the two, which needs addressing more, you know?
Even with all of this, I bet Nintendo got a lot of freaked out customer service calls about, you know, my Eternal Darkness game is messed up.
You never underestimate people's
stupidity.
No, I said non-awareness. Let's leave it at that.
I mean, you know, it's not stupid if you get hoodwinked by a insanity effect, but you shouldn't be fooled by it for more than 15 seconds. I mean,
you should feel pretty silly afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't want to call somebody.
Yeah.
I just got duped by Dayak.
Yeah.
There are babies crying in my game. Customer service, help.
Well, one thing we talked about last week was the fact that a lot of these characters, the characters that you play as, kind of meet unfortunate ends at the end of the chapter, or, you know, they either die or something bad happens to them. It's not every case, but there's a lot of bad shit that happens to your guys and girls in this game. And we had a sort of a reaction from that, I think, from Sundalos, who posted in the forums that one reason I've never been able to get into this game on a long-term basis is that it's so grim. Continually watching so many of the characters come to a bad end in most of the chapters gradually decreased my interest. I recognize it was a bold and fresh move on the part of Silicon Knights. However, this wasn't a narrative decision that I really appreciated as a gamer. I was never able to bring myself to care enough to finish the game. I suppose that Eternal Darkness just pushed the envelope a bit too far for me.
To me, it kept me interested because I kind of wanted to see how everybody's story would wind up. You knew it's kind of like a Twilight Zone episode. You knew that something bad was going to happen.
That's a good way of putting it.
But it was, how were you going to get there?
Yeah, I agree.
No, and I mean, it's just the relative novelty of it. I mean, like you said, you can point to stuff like Twilight Zone or something, but in games, you know, I mean, it's to me, just the fact that it is kind of fresh, it automatically makes it more palatable.
You know, I think at the end of Blood Omen, some pretty terrible stuff happens to Kane, and it that's basically the end of the game. And I think one reason that that Dennis truly dislikes the Soul Reaver series is that they sort of retconned the ending of Blood Omen and kind of, you know, to open up the possibility for a sequel. I mean, obviously, your character Azrael in the Soul Reaver games is not the same main character as you had in Blood Omen, but Kane is he's kind of the villain in the Soul Reaver games, and I think they really did not like the narrative direction because they felt like it was undoing some of the really innovative, dreadful stuff that they put into the end of their game, you know. Mm-hmm. But they lost control of that series. It's a big legal snafu, so they didn't have any say in
it. Well, for me, we talked about some of the gamier aspects of the game, the, you know, some of the combat issues and use of magic that makes it feel more like a game, and I think that's what prevented me from getting so freaked out or disturbed by this game that I didn't want to play it. I mean, back in my mind, I still knew this is a game, you know, people aren't really dying, sure, whatever. Yeah. You know, sometimes with a movie, if you're really engrossed, you're like, oh god, what's going to happen to this? But I knew I was playing a game, so maybe that's a sign of a failing, I guess, of the game here, because maybe I should have had a response like Sanjulos, but I didn't. Maybe yeah.
Well, if everyone had that response, the game wouldn't have been very successful, at, you know, in whatever way you want to define it.
Yeah, and but, I mean, you could still be kind of reminded of it being a game without completely rendering all its narratives, you know, intentions
right.
ineffective, yeah. You know.
But, you know, it's a very tricky balance, and you know, I don't envy them for trying to do that because, it's not a task that many developers would even attempt to do, and I think they did a pretty good job of it, but certainly looking back, you can say, well, they could have done better. But responding to Sundalos in the forums, Maxi posted, it was somewhat depressing that nearly everybody died, but it was a struggle for survival that intrigued me. It was the chance that good could overcome evil. The chance to survive was, in present time, learning of the past exploits of the people fighting this evil. I really liked how SK brought that out in the game. So I think Maxi got what Silicon Knights were going for in that It's not so much about your identification with this character or that character, but rather their collective efforts, and especially Alex, who's sort of the culmination of all of their efforts. But, you know, that's a long-term payoff.
Yeah.
And sure, if you only play the first few chapters, you're not going to get that sense of it at all.
Again, admirable, I think, as a matter of intent.
But difficult to pull off, difficult to convey to them.
Certainly. But, you know, it's nice to see somebody try.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, to me, the death of all the characters kind of gives you, it shows you kind of like the scope of sacrifice involved with fighting the evil. So it kind of makes it more meaningful as the game goes along because you see kind of what went into it.
And also, I mean, it gives a little punch to that, you know, because sometimes games stories can kind of just meander for long times, whereas this sort of episodic structure punctuated by these sort of the, you know, unpleasant events and stuff, just it keeps things kind of, keeps things moving, keeps things different, you know, to some extent with the changing up of locations and time zones and things. So it, you know, it's one way in which you can have a narrative driven game that does sustain your interest, because I think sometimes, you know, games, you know, people want games to be long. They're always like, how many hours is it and all that. But on the other hand, sustaining a narrative that's sort of consistently absorbing over that time is really difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this game definitely does well in that department.
Yeah, and I think the episodic structure is actually quite a lot to do with that. I think that was one of the really good ideas of it.
Yeah, and also really, like, in gameplay terms, I like how Alex's material interweaves in and out. And as you learn to do something in this chapter of something that happened in the past, you can then go apply it in the mansion with Alex to find the next chapter. And it may be a minor part of the game. You go solve this one little puzzle before you can move on with the next real chapter. But it does present this, and it reinforces the overall theme of, you know, what these people did in the past enables Alex to finally overcome the evil.
it's an important way in gameplay terms of emphasizing the interconnectedness, that this isn't just, you know, that there is actually and building an expectation that at some point this is going to pay off, probably at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I really like that a lot. Well, I think we need to wrap it up, but, I mean, any final thoughts here?
Well, there's one more question that I think that we need to cover. Do we want to see a sequel, and if so, what would it look like?
But, well, I mean, I don't know whether I'm best qualified to comment on this, having not even played through the entirety of the first one, so to speak, but I think a spiritual successor is probably what may be more in order. I mean, I'm not knowing the specifics of the end of the game, I don't know like what you could even possibly envision for a sequel, but for me, maybe something that's again episodic, again similar sort of, you know, the horror kind of themes and the psychological kind of themes and all that, but it doesn't have to be the same universe, or it doesn't have to be like interconnected characters, like just those general kind of themes and structures, and as Johnny kind of mentioned last week, you know, gameplay wise it could be quite different.
I could see almost a different genre.
Because you could still have the episodic structure, the horror themes, all that stuff in a very different kind of game, gameplay wise.
So my big question about this is, if there's a spiritual sequel, does it have to take place in essentially our history? Because a big part of Eternal Darkness was how it kind of had this interweaving with our history over the years, and is that a vital part of this kind of a game? And Silicon Knights loves doing that kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah,
but you know, maybe it's not. Maybe it focuses more on Chinese history or maybe American history. I don't know.
See, I was thinking like maybe the Anglo-Saxon Druids would be really nice territory for them to go into.
Yeah, again, it'd be kind of nice if they could pick something that was not that mindful thing. You know, like something that was kind of relatively virgin territory.
Oh, they seem good at that.
Yeah, but obviously that would kind of somewhat preclude some of what they've done before. With the Norse the sort of quasi-Norse mythology that's in Two Human, and obviously the stuff that they've covered, like the First World War and all that kind of stuff in Eternal Darkness.
So you agree that part of the charm is the real world base, like universe? I mean, if they had a completely fictional world, I don't think it would have the same effect. It wouldn't feel right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they have created their own fictional worlds, and they're quite interesting.
I guess the question is whether if it felt more detached, whether it would be as effective. You know, if it's felt a bit more sort of high fantasy, whether it could be as kind of effective on a psychological level.
Yeah,
I think the fact that it ostensibly takes place in our world is a nice element of it. But I think kind of what TYP suggested, that maybe they could, you know, focus it from, you know, center it on maybe a culture that most gamers are not as familiar with, like say it takes place in China or something. And then it goes through Chinese historical events, because I think that would be okay. It would still have that air of authenticity, knowing that they base it on real locations.
Yeah,
and maybe some real
events. It would kind of ground it, but at the same time.
But at the same time, it's okay that some of these historical events we're not necessarily familiar with, because you can already see in Eternal Darkness they go to locations and events and settings that you know are based on real things, but you don't know that much about them. That's why things like the stained glass and the old cathedral in Anthony's stage, they could have totally gotten away with that because most people wouldn't know the difference anyway. Mm-hmm. So I like that they're sticklers for that, but at the same time, I don't think it's key that they look at the fact that they chose World War I instead of World War II. That tells you everything.
World War One is ripe territory for horror, because in people's minds, it's just a very terrible conflict.
Yeah, very bloodthirsty.
Very non-strategic.
Yeah.
Almost, you know, just stalemating, attrition, just bloodbath. Anyway, potential for sequel. I mean, for all we know, they may be working on it right now. They, you know, Eternal Dark, I mean, Silicon Knights, as far as we know, are still working on something for Sega that has yet to be. It was announced, that deal was announced like 3 or 4 years ago, and they still haven't said a word about it. And they have talked about, you know, I mean, Dennis said in the last interview we did with him, which was just a couple years ago, that he would love to work with Nintendo again. And at the very least, would love to make something for Wii or DS, and possibly even go so far as to work with Nintendo again. And I'm I'm assuming that Nintendo holds the publishing rights still for Eternal Darkness and any kind of sequel that might spawn from it. I don't think it's something that Sega or Microsoft could publish, but you know, Silicon Knights is very keen on like retaining certain legal rights and especially developer recognition. They were kind of a pioneer in that, in like getting developer logos on boxes and putting them in the title screen, because you know, 15 years ago that was not done, and they were kind of very, very hardcore about that when in their publishing deals. It's like, you have to give us credit, we made this game, it's our ideas, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I kind of doubt they have clout or all the legal rights to go ahead and make Eternal Darkness 2 and let Microsoft publish it, for instance. So I think if there was a sequel, it would probably have to be another collaboration with Nintendo, and you would want it to be anyway, because that way, you know, they can kind of keep the same level of quality and polish, and that, you know, there are elements of Miyamoto in Eternal Darkness. It's kind of hard to believe, but him and the other producers, and there was a lot of input from Nintendo. So you would want that consistency.
Although, I mean, that refers to a sort of direct sequel, not the kind of sort of somewhat tangentially related kind of spiritual successor that we kind of talked about. So I guess
I don't think they would ever do a direct sequel in terms of like, here's what Alex did 5 years after the first story.
In terms of the IP part, you know, like they could.
I think they could totally do another Eternal Darkness game, but it would still be kind of a spiritual successor, just because I do think they would go in a different direction with it in some ways. But I think they could
still brand it
that way.
It's kind of like the Final Fantasy thing. Like, yeah, it's like the Final Fantasy.
Exactly.
Well, Final Fantasy 3, 4 and Final Fantasy 6 don't feature the same characters, you know?
Yeah. So. But what I'm saying is, if the game were to be sufficiently different in many ways anyway, but perhaps they could then just say, well, you know, the Eternal Darkness link would be kind of left implied, and therefore we could develop it for a HD system which may better suit our storytelling ambitions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in their two games post-Eternal Darkness, Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes and Two Human, they really haven't reused very many ideas from Eternal Darkness. They really haven't followed up on much at all that I would not in my view. So they certainly could very well go off and make like a kind of off-branded spiritual successor and just call it whatever they want, and you know, basically make it a sequel to Eternal Darkness with a different name. And they certainly would have the right to do that. And I think that would be pretty fresh, considering that it's been so long since Eternal Darkness was released, and they haven't followed it up yet. So that's going to finish it off, and that will end our retroactive discussion of Eternal Darkness. James, I'll certainly give him the floor if he wants to give any kind of final thoughts on it next week when he gets back. But in terms of formality, we're done with it. And the next game, let's see, the poll closed today, and the next game that we discuss is going to be Secret of Mana, the Super Nintendo Square RPG, action RPG,
so
I guess you would say.
So not Super Ghouls and Ghosts, I'm amazed.
No.
I'm still waiting for it.
Very sad. Very
it's like, that would be the worst retroactive ever, because no one would play it.
I'm still playing through the Ghouls and Ghosts. God, that's hard.
Yeah.
It's good.
The super graphics.
It's good though. It's good. Really good.
Anyway, Secret of Mana, we will take a week off next time, just to give everybody a chance to breathe and play other things. And then the week after that, hopefully we'll start the Secret of Mana discussion. So
I'll be playing this one on cartridge. Actually,
really.
So, wish me luck.
High rolling.
The save just doesn't fail on me like after.
Oh yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I downloaded it from Virtual Console when it came out, and I've barely touched it since then. So I'm glad that I'm gonna have a little more motivation to jump in there, and I'm gonna try to do some 2-player because I doubt I could get enough people to do 3-player for such a long game. But I hope I can do at least a few hours of 2-player because I never really did that back when I borrowed it from a friend on Super Nintendo. But anyway, I hope everybody will play along, and it's only $8, 800 Wii points on Virtual Console, so it's available in every territory as far as I know. So hopefully we're going to get some good participation, and I think it's a game worth discussing. There's some interesting things to be said about it, especially especially in retrospect. So thanks for everybody who voted, and please look forward to the next poll. I think that's all I've got for retroactive. Hope you enjoyed Eternal Darkness, and you're certainly welcome to keep posting in the forums about it. All those threads will stay open, and if you end up catching up with it a few weeks after the fact, you can by all means send us an email or something like that, and we'll definitely consider it for the show. And speaking of mail, that's what we're going to do when we get back from this break, your listener mail. Okay, and we are back for the third and final segment of the show. We're going to jump right into your listener mail, still catching up on the backlog a little bit. And these are from a couple weeks ago. And TYP has the first one.
All right. Kevin writes in from Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Kevin. I hope you're doing okay.
he's a Bills fan. He's probably not doing okay.
Oh.
All right. I usually play games solo. And when I'm shopping for games, it's the single-player experience I'm generally more interested in. So, when I sat down with the boyfriend the other day for a two-player game, we found our options a little thin. Boom Blocks and Wii Sports got old for us pretty quickly, and we ended up playing Super Mario Bros. 3 on the Virtual Console. Besides the obvious choices, like Mario Kart or Brawl, what are your favorite two-player experiences on Wii? Any lesser-known games, either rental or downloadable? Well, I have to qualify this by saying the last game I played two-player was 6 months ago, and it was Super Mario Bros. 3 on Virtual Console.
Wow. So,
it was with a coworker who I was showing him the Wii, and he's like, yeah, okay, that's kind of neat, but I want to play these Virtual Console games. So,
yeah.
So let's see.
Well, I wrote down a few. I know Kevin already has Zach and Wiki, so this is not so okay. much for him as it yeah. is. For our other listeners, but I think Zack and Wiki works pretty well as a two-player game because the second player basically just gets his or her own pointer, and you can't really manipulate objects so much as just kind of point things out.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about what the second player is doing with the controller; it's more about the discussion that the dialogue that you have while
kind
you're
of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. The puzzles are hard. And they require a lot of kind of lateral thinking, and it's really fun to get with another person, and you know you're both watching the game and paying attention to it, and to kind of work out some
try
potential
this,
solutions
try that,
between
you know,
the two of you.
It's kind of like what people talk about with Layton to an extent. Like some people say, like they play and talk with another person, but I think with Zach and Wiki,
I wouldn't do that with Layton.
That's what I'm kind of saying. Some people say that about Layton. I think Zach and Wiki. Is much more obviously literally has you can point around with a second controller, but just by the nature of the puzzles, they're a lot more kind of sort of creatively solved rather than sort of logically.
Exactly. So I also put down Trauma Center New Blood, very good
overlooked
Wii game.
That's what I'm gonna put down.
Has a nice two-player cooperative mode there, and it's really easy. You're both just pointing at the screen, so it works pretty well. The problem there is. Trauma Center being such a difficult and hardcore, old-school type game, you really need somebody who's probably at a similar skill level, you know?
Yeah.
It's not good to bring in a casual gamer with, but if you have two people who are into it, I think that could be really a lot of fun to go through the two-player on that. I wanted to put Excite Truck, but the two-player mode is so shitty in Excite Truck that it would be a great two-player game. But ExciteBots has a lot of potential, I think, and that's coming out next month in April. We don't know the full extent of the multiplayer stuff, but that has apparently been a focus.
All they've kind of talked about mostly is like six-player online so far, but you know, like hopefully the split-screen stuff will be in there because I still like that, and maybe even like the sort of Mario Kart style, you know, two-player local online would be cool.
That would be great.
Well, in the same vein, I he's probably already played it, but Super Mario Galaxy, I found that the second player option is actually kind of fun. Because, the co-star, it's a fun way to just sort of explore the level together, and, you know, you can, you know, since you have a pointer and you can see, it's like, oh, go this way, or see that over there, why don't you check that out?
Just muck around with the shoot the enemies and things, stun them with the star bits.
That never sounded very much fun to me, but I haven't really tried it, so.
I think it's more about the discovering the game together. together, I would exactly thought, for those yes two people. But it's not like, oh god, it's so fun to collect the star bits or whatever. But you know, Mario Galaxy is such a beautiful game that sharing the experience is nice, and just that sort of little extra interactivity is kind of nice to go along.
Right,
with that,
I mean. I remember when I was, you know, younger, with one of my good friends that we played video games, oftentimes we would just play a single-player game. One of us would just watch and say, hey, why don't you try this, or, you know, what's over yeah there? And it's sort of a way of formalizing it and making it so it isn't just that, you know?
And kind of encouraging it where, you know, it's just a little more inviting than, like, you just sit there while I play, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. For me, my most recent two-player dominated pickup was Tatsunoko versus Capcom. Which obviously is not out in America, but it's really good two-player game. You know, it really is a two-player game. There isn't much else to enjoy about it, but kind of for different reasons, it's similar to what you were talking about, Johnny, in terms of, like, you need someone that's relatively similar in skill for it to be really fun. Because, you know, to kind of enjoy, you know, the intricacies of the fighting system together. Mario Strikers is the good thing about that is that it's like the like Mario Kart, in the sense that you can go online as a team with someone next to you in the room and play sort of random matches as a team against other people that are so you've got the kind of online and local element that's good, although if you play random matches, then there will probably be, I don't know, maybe it's just nobody's on there anymore, but back when there were people on there, they used very unscrupulous tactics that just made the games unfun.
Snaking in soccer.
It wasn't quite, it was like spamming the defensive moves. All the time, which has just made it, it wasn't as if it was, you could counter it, but it just made everything tedious. Pro Evo Soccer, that's quite fun in two player. Obviously it's a really, really good, you know, sort of and different soccer game from normal. And
well, John has that, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Do you play that with your fiance?
No, I do not.
It is complicated. There is a high barrier to entry to this, almost regardless of your familiarity with soccer or even other soccer games. Because it is so different, so that is a barrier. But if you can sort of get a little rivalry going, that's pretty good. And there is a new one. The new one I think is already out in America in an ironic twist.
Yeah,
and it isn't quite out in Europe yet. But apparently that remedies some of the issues better online and stuff. So it could be a good pickup for anybody that's willing to give soccer a shot if they're not already a fan.
For me, I play WarioWare Smooth Moves, which is fun two-player. And the other one that me and my fiance like, ironically, is actually the voting channel. We actually really like doing the Wii voting channel.
I hear that a lot.
It's because it's almost like, it's kind of like mini trivia in a way. And the thing is, what I like about it is that it's interactive. You have to kind of say, hey, so how do you feel about that? Well, I feel about, you know, this way about it. You know, you can kind of, you know, you can see what you agree on, what you disagree on. So I think it's actually a lot better than I thought it would be. And I enjoy it more than I thought I would.
So, are there any other maybe downloadable games that might be good? I mean,
Tetris Party. Yeah, you've got Tetris Party, haven't you, John?
That's also very good.
I don't know. For me, I have Tetris, Party, and the problem with Tetris Party is it's just Tetris.
Exactly.
So.
Yep.
It's a little underwhelming if you've played a lot of Tetris in the past.
But that's the thing. At least, yeah, so many people have played Tetris. You know, we talk about this barrier to
absolutely.
There's you've got the Virus Buster co-op mode in Dr. Mario. Is quite
that's a good one.
Maybe I didn't try it.
See, I think if you're looking for a puzzle game, like a downloadable kind of thing that's cheap, a nice one that is not overly familiar is Groovin' Blocks. It has really good two-player modes. In fact, I've played one of them with Kevin. He's a friend of mine. But Groovin' Blocks, I think, is very overlooked WiiWare game. It's really well made. It's like 800 points, not overpriced at all. You get a good value out of it, and it's really well done. It's kind of a nice twist. It's not just another Tetris clone. It kind of has its own take on things. So if you're looking for more puzzle stuff, that one has a really nice local two-player mode. And then, of course, Secret of Mana is one of the very rare two-player RPG-type games. So if you're looking something really long-term...
Bomberman, of course. Bomberman Blast WiiWare.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You could go because you can do local online in that as well. You know, like a group, I think 4 people to the same console, and then go online with those. So that's another way of exploiting that.
Yeah, and that's a really good, you know, Bomberman's a great casual game. It's really easy to teach somebody to play it. My mom kicks ass at Bomberman, oddly enough.
I'm slightly hesitant to recommend it, but if he's a fan of like Kirby games, he could download Kirby's Dream Land 3. It has a co-op GUI. I mean, there may be other virtual console games like that that have kind of a two-player co-op mode that I can't think of right now. So it may be worth looking into that, too.
Contra. Oh, yeah. There
you go.
There's your low barrier to entry right here.
Yeah. Either you...
Why did I just die?
Don't ask questions. Just keep playing.
All right. Well, I guess that's a pretty damn thorough answer to that question, so we should move on. And Mr. Lindemann has the next.
All right. Okay. Adolf Vega in Denton, Texas, he writes... a bunch of gibberish, blah, blah, blah.
No, what did you have to do it?
I got to read it? Oh, man.
You don't have to read it. You have to sing it.
Oh, okay. Gold. Why do I always get these questions, man? Golden Eye. Radioactive Golden Eye. Watch us out for the unicorns who want to eat the rainbows as the Martian acrobats defeat the robot insectoids from Planet X who drive out the Octorok. Of the Millennium, and that's the end of the song.
Kind of falls apart at the end there.
Yeah, it does.
He kind of lost it. Next time he'll have to try harder to completely make an ass of me. And here's the actual question: is iPhone a serious threat to DSi? They're both aimed at the casual gamer market, and they have similar price points. So is the iPhone a threat to DSi?
Do they have similar price points in America?
No, actually, they don't. The iPhone, I mean, I got mine as a deal, and I got mine for $300, so...
Well, that must have been a while back, because they're quite a bit cheaper now.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, we distinguish between iPhone and the iPod Touch stuff as well.
Right.
I mean,
they do both
the
play
iPhone.
The games.
Mm-hmm.
So.
They do. Yeah. But I've had mine for several months, and I still have yet to download any games for my iPod Touch. So.
Oh, I would download a ton if I had one. Because I listen to Listen Up and that crap, and they're always talking about these
Scramboni. The only one I've grabbed, Rolando. And that's pretty good. It's a pretty good game.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about Rolando.
I would definitely try that.
Yeah, it's cool.
I think if you think about what the DSi is kind of going for, and again, I know I'm going to get railed at for continuing to make this comparison, but it is very much a Game Boy Micro style attempt to get at, I think, a more stylish kind of more fashion-oriented market who don't know as much about gaming. I mean, it just seems that way to me. Like these cameras and everything, you're selling, the average Nintendo fan, for one thing, has already probably bought Nintendo DS twice, and packing in two Game Boy cameras is not going to make you want to get it a third time. They're going for a completely different section. I think they're going for people, and certainly in Japan, they were going for people who had not already bought a DS.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people in Japan who were just like crazy hardcore people that had to buy it again. There's bound to be some of those people because there's some people that just buy a new color. So if you actually throw new functionality
crazy...
There's always a little hardcore,
That's not the real market here.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, the big thing is digital distribution on DSi, moving towards, like the App Store. I mean, I think that is a convergence there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. DSiWare is all about the potential. I mean, you say that's the big thing, but really the big thing in DSi are the cameras. That is the upfront thing. That's the thing that's easy to explain in a commercial, that's easy to sell to people. It's like, look, it's got cameras. You can play with your face on it. The DSiWare is more aimed at those hardcore people. And that's all potential right now. It's totally
It is all potential, but I think it's something they're looking at. You look at some of the stuff that's already in Japan and the kind of breadth of, it's very much apps kind of stuff, like calculators, public transport things. Mm.
iPhone crap.
Yeah, so it suggests that they are, trying to, occupy a similar space, maybe cut them off of the pass a little bit, You know, I mean, it's so in that sense, Nintendo's behavior sort of infers that there is some threat there. Yeah. But I mean, there are different. There's obviously big differences. I mean, like, you know, if you play, especially like iPhone, like I can't imagine that people would necessarily want to like really severely run down their phone battery all the time playing games on it.
Yeah.
And I know like some of the more complicated games can consume quite a lot of power quite quickly. On an iPhone, so
and that's
you know,
an argument
I think
for the
iPod
Touch.
I think the iPhone is probably like more for the very small gaming experiences, whereas you know, like for DS, obviously, you know, that's all it's there for. So that's for your more sustained play sessions, and you know, for some people, you know, handheld CODs is more handheld than it is portable in terms of you know, it's kind of like
yep.
they'll play it. On the couch with something on the TV, or you know,
that's me.
It's yeah. not so much like, oh, I'm playing it on the bus, I'm playing it standing up on the train, or you know, it's not so much that. So, I think the iPhone or the iPod Touch or is very much more in that explicitly portable area,
mm-hmm.
whereas the DS remains sort of comfortably in the kind of handheld thing. So, there's still divided lines,
yeah. And I think the biggest divided line is simply that DSiWare is not an open system like the iPhone App Store.
Yeah, that's a big divided line.
Like, I have friends who will only download apps for their iPhones that are free because there are so many. That you
yeah.
can download a lot of useful crap that I don't know why people make these, but they put them out there and they're free or at least free versions of things. And you're not going to get that on DSi because you have to have an actual developer kit to make something for DSiWare. And if you go to that trouble and buy all that equipment, you're going to charge something for it.
Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, you look at it actually, the first several months of DSi in Japan. I think there may have been a third-party game at this point, but that's about it. I mean, it's Nintendo, everything, even you know, whether it's the calculators or whatever, it's all by Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they announced that thing out of the blue in Japan.
Yeah,
it came out
sure.
very quickly. And so, they're, you know, even if developers were interested, and I'm not sure that they are, you know, I'm not sure that third parties will ever support that much. It depends on the install base. It's
yeah, a wait and see kind of policy is probably, which is why you know Nintendo may prove to be a little more invested in DSiWare than they have been in WiiWare, because they're going to actually try and push it a little more, and then maybe it'll succeed, and then maybe everyone else will get on board a bit later.
Yeah, well, I think that to a very large degree, Nintendo's trying to sow the seed for the next portable, just to kind of either try out the DSiWare kind of model. And just you know, see how it works and see how it catches
on. Yeah, I'd agree with that. That you know how much, because you know, conceivably they could go more towards the digital distribution angle on a you know, like for the more yeah, the main games, so to speak, that you know, the what we would deem now retail games.
Yeah.
Because you know that you know they're so bloody pissed off about R4 and piracy and all that. Anything they could do to sort of get around that in the future is something they'll pursue. So if they could cultivate a downloadable market on their portables and you know with this, then maybe they'll pursue it more.
But they can't because the technology isn't up to par, because it has basically the same extremely limited space constraints and very much tied down transfer capability, even to the built-in SD card. That the Wii does, and so you're not going to be able to deliver a retail size game.
Oh no, but but that's why we were talking about this being the proving ground for another system in the future
mm-hmm.
that would actually
exactly. And I'm just not interested in financing that experiment.
Exactly, that's the problem. A lot of people are going to say,
"That's
I'm not
what
interested.
I." It's exactly what I see it as an experiment.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I'm not sure whether I'll ever get one. I mean, I'm not talking about a personal point of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking about what Nintendo's intentions are and how that applies to their sort of rivalry or their relationship with Apple.
Right. Well, of course, another problem with the iTunes Store is that it's really hard to browse through the games there, in my opinion. And there's poor word of mouth is the only thing a lot of these games have going for them too. And it's not quite the same for DS, you know. Maybe
you think
DSi,
it's a bit of an overload, like there is just so much stuff that it's very difficult to filter through, like, you know, whereas...
There is.
But at the same time, it's all extremely democratic because of that. you know.
Yeah, it's true.
And the reason they're going on word of mouth is because they're developed by extremely small developers, sometimes just one person. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have marketing budgets and things. But DSiWare will be a completely different situation. It'll still be poorly marketed, but it'll be poorly marketed by Nintendo.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
But what it'll have is, like, I guess, you know, you'll be developed by developers that people will know to some extent, and maybe that'll just, maybe. Yeah, that'll be sort of the indication, or obviously use franchises that people know.
Well, I think it'll also kind of push from a Nintendo standpoint the whole thing of, hey, if you thought, you know, our games were cheap to produce before, look at what you can do now with this hardware. You can make a really, really small game, something like Brain Age, and, you know, people will buy the heck out of it. So it really...
They're probably giving out DS kit development kits for free at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 5 years,
so... So, I mean, this isn't exclusive to discussion of, like, portable distribution or the DSi, and but if they were to go this completely in the digital distribution route, anyone, Sony on their next system, Microsoft on their next system, what does that do for retailers? I mean, there's going to
fuck
be a problem.
Fuck some over.
Yeah. I mean, they're in this weird holding pattern right now where it's like they need each other for now, but the retailers know they're just waiting. Yeah, once internet capacity kind of catches up to where it needs to be, in terms of, because there's still parts of the US that are not really sufficiently connected to the internet. There's issues with internet connectivity over here, you know. I mean, there's big part of Australia, I think, you know, there's still huge parts of the world where it's like download caps and all this stuff that kind of gets in the way, but it's only a matter of time until those obstacles fall away, and then when they can pursue a more digitally distributed sort of system, they will, because the piracy thing. I mean, look at PSP and UMD, you know, it's killed them.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. They hate that. They absolutely hate it, and they will do
UMD didn't have much to do with the piracy situation.
Well, the firmware, the firmware, the hackable sort of, you know, as well.
I mean, I think eventually what you'll see happen is you'll walk into Walmart with, say, your PSP or your DS or whatever happens to come out, and instead of having shelving with games on it, you'll have a kiosk that'll just have an internet terminal there, and you can log into it.
There could be a way of kind of bridging the gap a bit in terms of keeping retailers in the loop.
But that's such a middleman solution. I mean, is the consumer going to stand for that when they know I think that might be
more applied in those areas that aren't necessarily that well served by internet connection. That would be like the sort of Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you still have to go into the store anyways, right? I mean, if you're going to go and buy an actual copy of a game, you still have to go into the store. So the only
people don't want to go to the store.
I'm just saying. For
people. Yeah, well, that's why it would probably be like I said, it's a sort of Band-Aid in these places where they may not want to, but they still have to because like internet. If you've got a situation where internet connections have kind of permeated to a point where it's almost everywhere's good, but you've still got a few places that, you know, are kind of a problem, then you could run these sorts of schemes there, and then maybe in some other places, you know, you would just operate them for people who are just kind of, you know, not necessarily like that tech savvy or something, you know, just something you could offer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at it, Johnny, from the standpoint of, you know that retailers are going to want a chunk. They're going to want a piece of the action, right? They're not going to allow themselves to just be pushed out of the picture, so...
Sure. But right now, they have all the action.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, I think the problem is the retailers are so powerful, especially in America. I'm not sure if it's quite this way in other parts of the world. But right now, the retailers are the only gateway through which you can go buy a game, except, you know, Steam and WiiWare and you know, XBLA have made some very small nicks in that armor. But what you're going to find is that as digital distribution becomes more and more potent, especially among the consoles, the platform holders are going to take out a significant chunk. Now, certainly, it won't happen overnight. There will always be people who want to go to the store. That is it'll take a long time to completely do that. But what these retailers are not going to stand for their market shrinking that much. They're going to fight it very much, even though they will still have some customers, as you said, in places with poor internet or people who don't trust non-physical media.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at the whole Wii kind of movement, right? Selling things with peripherals, selling them to the people they're selling them to. I mean, that's totally retail.
Guitar Hero, Rock Band.
Yeah, I mean, all those things. These really mainstream things they are very, very much retail. So you may end up getting a sort of segmented kind of market for selling games. And the really mainstream stuff will still be on shelves in stores. And then you'll have these kind of kiosks that will serve a lot of the downloadable stuff as well. But then the people who are sort of really traditional gamers are just like, you know, they'll have to download everything or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It'll be a process. It'll be evolution. You know, I don't think it'll be so much of a, you know, cut-off point, and then it's like, right, that's it. We're going digital, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, the retailers have been so successful lately because of things like all the Wii accessories and Guitar Hero, Rock Band, etc. And especially the used game market, which is a huge thing for them right now in the recession. So I think they can stand to survive a little bit of market shrinkage caused by digital download. I mean, they've made so many gains even in the past 5 years. GameStop is one of the most successful businesses in the country. It's like one of the few businesses that's actually growing right now instead of shrinking.
Yeah.
And so it's not going to hurt them if they lose 5% of their business in a couple years to digital distribution, but at the same time, they're going to fight it because that's their nature. But it's not like it's going to put them out of business. That's over a decade down the line, at least.
The thing is, I mean, I don't think that they really can fight it, but they'll make it work for them.
Yeah, they'll get concessions, maybe.
Yeah.
Sure. Greg has the next
one. Alright, I've
question.
Got the next one. This is Tyson writing in from Arkansas. And it says, so, I've played some Mirror's Edge, and it got me thinking about Metroid. What if a new first-person Metroid game implemented some of the same jumping mechanics, namely wall jumping, from Mirror's Edge? I know Mirror's Edge reception has been mixed, but if the controls were smoothed out, I think it could make for a freer and more nimble way to traverse whatever planet or planets Samus finds herself on next. So, Johnny, you're the resident Mirror's Edge authority.
And Metroid.
I actually played it.
Yes.
I think any idea for implementing wall jump better in the Metroid series is definitely worth considering. And I think the way Mirror's Edge handles it is a viable option. I mean, the execution would have to be a lot better, obviously. You know, I mean, wall jumping is pretty damn shady, even in Super Metroid. They've gotten better at it over the years. It's a lot easier in Fusion, for instance, and Zero Mission. But I don't like the way it was handled in Echoes, and I guess it's in Corruption, too.
It's very minor. It's just limited to those bits of the panels on the wall.
It's very scripted and kind of pointless. I mean, it's sad because the screw attack itself, I thought they did a great job of implementing. I mean, you know, you can use it anywhere, and if you're creative, you can find good uses for it in a lot of different situations where they didn't necessarily expect you to use it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wall jumping, unfortunately, is so limited that it's just kind of a showpiece.
It's kind of a bit of a box tick, isn't it? Like, we've got wall jumping in it, and we just put these little panels in.
It's not even really gameplay. It's pretty perfunctory.
I mean, I think with the idea, I quite like the idea of bits in a Metroid game being kind of purposefully designed so that you would have a part which could have some more complicated jumping and obstacles and stuff, so long as kind of like you really was almost like play like a little mini level once, but then at the end of it basically you fought a boss and you got an item that after that it would not be tedious to retraverse.
And they've done that a little bit.
Yeah, the classic example is something like, so you could have this like really complicated sort of obstacle course of jumping and all that, and then you get the speed boost and you can just burst through the bottom of it afterwards. You know, and so you never really have to think of, because so much of Metroid is crisscrossing the world, it's all well and good like carefully designing this little thing, but you know, you wouldn't want to keep doing that all the time.
Right.
The kind of more complicated kind of platforming of something like Mirror's Edge, you could incorporate into a Metroid game as long as you did it carefully like that. You know, and so that it kind of works in a kind of backwards and forwards way.
Is wall jumping disorienting in Mirror's Edge? I haven't played it, but like, to me it sounds like going first person and wall jumping just seems like it would be so disorienting.
Yeah.
Do you get used to it
pretty fast. At first it's very disorienting, but you definitely get used to it after a while. It's not so bad. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be disorienting in Mirror's Edge, and they do a lot of tricks with the camera, the way it shakes, the kind of feeling of that your body has a weight to it and that you have momentum. They do all these things to make it less disorienting, even though they make maybe what's happening on the screen is actually more complex. You know, there's more jiggle or the camera's moving. It's all in a way, it's all descended from the trick that they did in the first Metroid Prime, where when you jump, Samus tilts her head down just a little bit, so you can see the platform in front of you as you come down onto it. Mirror's Edge kind of takes that and expands it in a lot of different directions, and so there are ways you can deal with that to make it less disorienting, and there's also maybe a learning curve. So I don't know if this is the best way to incorporate more wall jumping into the 3D Metroids, but I would like for them to find a better way than what they've used so far.
I'd rather see them expand the like they have the morph ball puzzles that go into 2D. It seems like that might be a better place to start doing wall jumping too.
Yeah, absolutely. I like those because they're kind of self-contained, and you do them once, and they don't really affect your ability to re-traverse after that. So yeah,
sure. And now, since you mentioned speed boosting, I'll just say that I'm still waiting for them to do speed boost in Metroid Prime. I think it could be
exhilarating, couldn't it?
Yeah,
you know, really legitimately, awesome if they did
it right. Yeah. Not simple to design for, but possible.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge.
Anyway, I think the other aspect of this, and Tyson wrote a long email, I had to trim it down a little bit, but putting Mirror's Edge kind of acrobatics into Metroid Prime might feel weird because Samus is wearing this big tank suit, right? But he mentioned the possibility, and this goes back to something Greg wrote about on the site for a Metroid feature we did, the possibility that maybe you have the ability to switch on and off the suit. So sometimes you play intentionally as Zero Suit Samus, and that would give you more mobility, maybe some stealth ability. So, you know, depending on the situation, you might actually choose to take off the suit and play as Zero Suit Samus. And in that case, I think more of this wall jumping, wall running kind of stuff would make a lot of sense. So that's a pretty cool idea too.
And again, you, as I said in the thing, you know, you could sort of design it so to some extent it's flexible, like you can kind of choose how you want to play, but another it says it would be parts that were more dedicated. And, you know, you could create more of these sort of intricate obstacle course type designs.
Sure, you got to use a Zero Suit to infiltrate the pirate fortress to get an upgrade for your power suit. I mean,
yeah, well, it's very much sort of taking what they did in Zero Mission at the end and kind of applying it more broadly. That was the idea.
Well, to wrap up the discussion and continue the comparison with Zero Suit, I don't remember if I ever talked about it on the show, but there's a 2D Flash version of Mirror's Edge. It's officially sanctioned by EA, so you can find it online. It's totally legal and free to play, and it's Mirror's Edge in 2D, basically, and it's awesome. And it's I think it's actually more fun than the actual 3D Mirror's Edge. And now that I think about it, it does remind me quite a bit of the Zero Suit parts in Metroid Zero Mission. So if you're interested in maybe what that might feel like, or, you know, if you like the Zero Suit stuff and you want to get more of it, it's not stealth based, but the platforming actually feels quite similar, because of the weight of the character and the way you're grabbing onto ledges and pulling yourself up, things like that. So, I think that's definitely worth your time to go look up the 2D Flash Mirror's Edge. It's badass. All right. The last question, I've got this one. It's Grizz writes in from Jamaica. Recently, you were talking about DS games that are coming out soon, but GTA Chinatown Wars wasn't one of them. So, what do you guys think about it? How do you think it will live up to the GTA franchise? I think the graphics work for the DS, and the gameplay looks great. Your thoughts?
Kind of burnout on GTA.
Yeah, me too.
That's my
first
thought.
Did you actually play Lost and Damned after, I think, where we left off with John previously?
No, I actually have not played Lost and Damned.
Yeah, so you burned out on it even though you bloody bought more of it.
Yeah.
But then didn't play it.
I had no plans to even buy Lost and Damned, but there was a deal on it.
Okay. But yeah, so you are, I guess it's demonstrative that burned out you are, that you can't even be bothered to play something you've already paid for.
Exactly.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm a bit burned out on GTA as well. I wouldn't say burned out. It's just that I didn't like 4 that much. I guess that's what I should say. I'm pretty pretty low on GTA 4, even though I own it, but...
Do you think that, I mean, but, you know, say for instance, I'm not entirely familiar with this, because I'm not a GTA guy, I've never
Me
owned
too,
one,
yeah.
I don't intend to play one, really, but if it were more, like, a bit less take itself seriously, the like
yes.
4 was, and a bit less grim, like,
which I think
Chinatown was, you know, because of its style and stuff, it's a bit more whimsical.
I've already ordered Chinatown Wars along with Henry Hatsworth in my ongoing parade of
it's
of
starting though,
power.
Isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of good DS stuff coming out.
These are the 5th and 6th games respectively that I have purchased for DS in 2009.
Wow.
In 3 months I've purchased 6 DS games. That's kind of scary for me.
Well, you know, I'm impressed. I have not bought any DS games, so.
Yeah.
No, not really. I haven't bought, like, you know, Mahjong game or something.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Dude, over here in the West, it's been a pretty intense Q1 for DS, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be interested, Johnny, to see what you think of Chinatown Wars, because you're just like
me.
I mean, you've played through GTA 4, or at least played
right.
deep into it.
Well,
so
part of what attracts me to Chinatown Wars is that because it has a different perspective and everything,
yeah.
and it focuses on some different aspects of gameplay, and it's a totally different character who apparently really has no dealings at all with Nico.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping it'll be different enough from GTA 4 that it'll really feel like a totally different experience.
Yeah,
for me.
Sure.
That's
yeah.
what I'm thinking. Thereof. Like, I'm wondering if I'm just if I'm probably not burnt out on Grand Theft Auto overall. I'm just burnt out on the console Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah,
you know,
I greatly prefer San Andreas and Vice City over GTA 4. So, I mean, Chinatown Wars does take place in the Liberty City of 4, but it's presented in such a different way I'm not too worried about that. It's more the style and the story of GTA 4 that really kind of bring me down a lot. So, I just watched some videos of it the other day, and I was so impressed by the graphics engine and the way the gameplay looks to be kind of strung together that I just pretty much immediately threw it in with Henry Hatsworth. So I haven't gotten either one of those yet.
I will say that we just received our review copy a couple of days ago, and it's been sent out. I think Nick DiMolo will be reviewing it, so hopefully we'll have some coverage on that shortly after this goes up.
The early reviews are exceptionally positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the other factor that went in. You know, when GameSpot gives it a 9.5, I'm like, whoa, that's means something. I don't know what, but that's especially in recent years, they really don't give out scores like that. So
no, you know, and the funny thing is, I mean, the DS, everybody talks about how amazing its software library is at this point, and I think that's entirely accurate. It's incredibly diverse and it's incredibly quality.
It's all third party stuff, which makes it diverse. You know, it's not
just
Nintendo cranking out.
Yeah, but what I was going to say is that it is actually has been difficult for games on the DS to actually score that highly. Mm-hmm. You know, like most of the sort of aggregate scores of the best sort of rated DS games are in the sort of the early 90s, where, you know, they're not up, you know, like Galaxy's 97 or whatever, and, you know, they never quite get that high. I guess people just don't seem to quite agree as much about DS games, about how good they are.
Yeah,
so
that's probably part of it.
Yeah,
yeah, and it'd be quite interesting to see if sort of Chinatown Wars could actually buck the trend, because I guess because, you know, it kind of could bring together all those things that, you know, the gaming media seems to like in terms of the sort of technical achievements and the sort of mature rated aspect and all that kind of thing.
And I think it's a console style experience.
Yeah,
you know?
So it could be like a sort of perfect storm of things that kind of mm-hmm. gets the gaming media's attention that you haven't even had yet on DS, funny, for all the great games it has done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I could imagine a lot of people be quite excited.
It does seem like it's filling in a gap on DS that, you know, that has been there for a while. It's just the kind of game that you don't normally get on DS, where it is kind of geared more towards older players who are looking for a very lengthy, sort of epic 30-hour, 40-hour game, and and it's more exploration-based, I guess. There's just a there's a lot of things that it does that you really don't get in very many DS games. That doesn't mean it's automatically great.
Yeah.
But it makes it interesting to me. It makes it stand out in a sea of a lot of DS games that sometimes can get, you know, I really don't need another strategy RPG for DS. Yeah, anyway, Chinatown Wars, I probably didn't mention it a few weeks ago, because at that point I really didn't know much about it and wasn't that interested, but hopefully I'll be talking about it next week. So I'm interested now, damn it. All right, that's going to wrap up our show. Thanks to everybody who's been sending emails. You can send your email and potentially get it read on the show to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we definitely enjoy all the great questions and thinking about them, talking about them. It's been a lot of fun. And TYP, you want to pimp your podcast?
Us, you can also listen to Radio Trivia Podcast Edition normally every other week, although it's kind of an exception lately. But do check it out and check out the older episodes if there isn't a new one.
They're all
but yeah,
great.
It's a lot of fun. And, you know, listen to music, try to figure out what game it is, and we talk about the game a little. So it's kind of a nice balance between what you get here on RFN and some music. So
it's kind of like a really long new business with a lot of music cut in. That's how I think about it sometimes. But maybe that's just when I'm co-hosting, I tend to drone on and on and on.
I just prefer to hear from Dr. Hibbert when I'm listening to Radio Trivia or something like that. You know, Dr. Nick or whatever, Bill Cosby in The Simpsons.
The bippin' and the boppin'
all about.
There you go. That's what you got to look forward to.
TYP is a radio master. He will be running his own morning show one day, I have a feeling. That's a great podcast. I really would like everybody who listens to RFN to check that one out too. That would be great. And vice versa. That's going to wrap the show for us. And we'll see you next week. Hopefully James will be back. And looking forward to it. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Let us know how we did. Hit up the talk back in the iTunes reviews and all that. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It'll be around forever.